I thought for a split second, should I tell him I'm a cop? Then I said, nah, you know what? If I tell him I'm a police officer, the first thing they're going to be thinking is, like, this guy's strategical, he's tactical, he's probably sharp on his toes, he's very observant, and they're going to be right.
Welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again in the Patron Zone, and for the first time in the Cagayan Zone. Dom, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Really looking forward to talking about this one. I would say that the patrons made a good choice. We chose it, but we took all of your suggestions under advisement and correctly came to this conclusion, which I'm sure lots of people will be happy about. So very glad to be sinking our teeth into this. Not glad to be having to relearn how to say Cagayan, which I still haven't mastered after 6.5 years. But everything else about this season, I really am looking forward to. This was one of our favorites to cover in real time all those years ago. And I think even with the roster of seasons that we've revisited now, where we've made sure to revisit ones which we think are deep and are exciting and we're going to have a good time talking about, and you'll have fun listening to us talk about, this is right up there for me. This is out there with the best of them.
Absolutely. And yes, I do think it is worth noting, this is the first time we're ever going to go back and do a full episode by episode rewatch of a season we were actually around to cover in real time. And so we are going to be able to sprinkle in, I think, more details and more things we remember from as it was happening live. And literally my very first memory of Survivor Cagayan is seeing that was going to be the title and wondering to myself for perhaps like months at a time, how do I pronounce this? And I would hear so many different pronunciations of this word. And I remember actually solidifying the correct one in my mind because of a Gordon Holmes tweet, who was like there on location, and he had to send out like an official pronunciation guide on how to say the title of this season.
Yeah, I haven't heard from Gordon in a long time. Hope he's all doing okay. But yeah, that was one of the many things which in the preseason we were kind of obsessing over, just at the time where we felt a need to cling to a greater degree of professionalism than we do now, where at the time it wasn't a completely losing battle just yet, and we wanted to make a good impression. By now, you know, if we flub that, then what's the big deal? Who even loses out on that?
Yeah, I'm also now thinking through, first of all, Cagayan, and any words with multiple A's in them fall squarely in the Dom is going to be of no use in helping me pronounce this, because I never know if he's pronouncing it like the British way or the way it's actually supposed to be pronounced. And I'm sure we'll get more into that as we talk more about Tasha Fox, Dom, your girl. But the other early memory I have of Cagayan, and I will not be going back and listening to any of these old podcasts, but I do remember back in the day when we did preseason cast assessments and drafted the cast of this, Tony was the 17th person selected out of 18. So definitely want to get our hand up right away on the fact that we were not Tony Vlachos believers early on.
Yeah, our preseason cast assessments with one K and two S's there, just to in case anyone wasn't joining the I's and dotting the T's, or wait, vice versa. Whatever. You get the point. But yeah, we that was one of our many missed calls on that season. And that's what made Cagayan so great, which was that we weren't quite sure what to expect coming in. What I do remember from that preseason assessment was so many people we were saying, I'm just not seeing it, or like a lot of people are high on this person and I don't get why everyone is so high on them, or like I remember saying about specifically Jatia, she is the one I have the most questions about. She could either be one of the greatest players we've ever seen, or she could just flame out dramatically in the first episode, and maybe a little bit of both, Colin. I don't know, I'm not sure if the jury is still out on that one. There was a lot of questions that we had unanswered, and even after watching the season, finishing it then, and now going back to revisit it after all these years, there's still a lot that I just don't quite know what I think about the season there. And there's still so much to sink our teeth into that feels new and feels fresh.
I mean, I remember you, not only preseason, but throughout the duration of the season, were... I'm still not clear on how sincere versus ironic this take was, but I'm pretty sure it was in earnest. A big time LJ guy. Do you have memories of that? And would you stand by that take?
Wasn't an LJ fan, still an LJ fan, maybe less so given that I'm sure he's, you know, sucked his head up his ass with some stupid tweets since then or whatever.
Are you guessing that that has happened?
I'm pretty sure I heard something to that effect. A few years ago now, maybe LJ has gone on the apology tour and has but maybe he's rehabilitated himself since then, not quite sure. Either way, that's a canonical example of how, you know, you want to be able to latch onto a favorite and call your shot early, and if they're right, you look like a genius. Sometimes it's not right and you look like an idiot, but that's part of the fun of doing this. And anyone who said back in February 2014 that they had a really good feeling about this Tony guy would have been handsomely paid off for that in due time.
Many people were handsomely paid off during season 40 betting situations where Tony was not one of the favorites among the most of the markets that I saw when people were doing things unspoiled. But in thinking through just kind of a couple other things before we dive into the specifics here, I know I've talked for a long time about Kageyan being certainly in the mix for my favorite season of all time, if not literally my number one favorite Survivor season of all time. And I frankly do think, at least prior to this rewatch, and maybe somehow my opinion will come down, I guess I'm open to that possibility, but I think with a gun to my head at this point, I probably would say Kageyan is my number one favorite. I know you are very high on it, to say the least, but has it been in that same conversation for you?
Absolutely. I think when we were wrapping up our coverage of the season at the time, we said if it's not at the top in its own tier, it's certainly in competition with just a handful of others. And since then, I think events have only really borne that out. And with a lot of the seasons that go down as one of the best of all time, sometimes not much happens to embellish or change their legacy over the years, and they're just kind of preserved in aspic in a kind of museum ready status. And then other seasons, maybe you see some of those players come back again and their performances there contextualize what happened in their original season, or sometimes just other things happen where maybe the things that you liked about that season that were unique at the time become a staple of the show, in part because they worked so well in that original season. Or things can happen to where your assessment of the season, the moment it ends, is maybe not quite the same as your assessment a few years down the line. With this season, firstly, the class of 28 has had a hell of a past few years where not only have you had Tony coming back and winning again, you have Sarah coming back to win and then come oh so close herself in conjunction with Tony to winning again, and then cementing Cops R Us as one of the most successful and iconic reality TV alliances of all time. But you have Spencer, who was this incredible fan favorite coming out of the season, coming back, and then the reception to him changing and evolving, and his own, the artist formerly known as Spencer, his Survivor journey and how it pertains to real life has been a real roller coaster over the years. And then you have Tasha coming back and being a finalist too. It's easy to overlook that, even though we shouldn't. Cass and Wu also just joining that roster of returning players from the season. I haven't run the numbers. It wouldn't surprise me if Kageyan had more returning players than basically any other season in the modern age. I'm sure you have those numbers on hand to jump in here. So
I would take Survivor Australia Season 2 as having more eventual returnees, but you are right.
Hence the qualifier in the modern age, which Australia decidedly is.
Listen, Dom, modern is a very relative term. I wouldn't describe the year 2001 as non-modern.
Yeah, I'm actually the only pure old school Survivor fan. Only Borneo is a legitimate season, yeah. And everything else is a terrible offshoot.
Anything that came after Borneo, people knew what to expect, and it's thus immediately tainted. It is the all time tainted jury pool problem here. I don't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, even the Mario Lanzas of the world are filthy casuals by this standard. But I think so this season has had many opportunities to enhance its own reputation in retrospect. And even after seeing another 12 seasons since then, it's really hard for any of those, including the season that Tony returned to win here, hold a candle to Kaguya-an. I think it really has stood the test of time, and for an all newbie season in that day and age to really remain in that upper echelon, it's quite something. Because if you think back to that time in early 2014, we were coming off a few years where Survivor was really having a kind of rocky road, where after Heroes vs. Villains, we have Nicaragua, which highly polarizing season, Redemption Island, regarded by many as the worst Survivor season of all time, or at least in the bottom tier, South Pacific, which was when we got into the podcasting game, which I know we were both quite high on, but that's another one where you read some rankings, it's near the top, you read others, it's just in the bottom, and they don't understand how anyone could disagree on that. And then One World, which it seemed like had so much potential, and it's great insofar as it's this exhibition for how to play Survivor. You know, you have one of the best winners of all time, one of the best winning games of all time, but the season itself, not much to write home about. And then Philippines, which I guess technically is a returning player season, but one of the things that made that season so great was those returning players were kind of an afterthought. They blended into the cast pretty well, I thought. That was one of the all-time great seasons. And I know we came out of season 25 really thinking, if this is the new standard for the franchise, then we could be doing this for the rest of our lives. This is great. And then Karamoan just kind of ruined that and really sent things back into a tailspin again. And then Blonde versus Water was this weird enigma coming out of that, where I think it was a good season, but a unique one, and not one whose formula you could really hope to replicate as a recipe for success moving forward. So for Kaguya-an, I think it was quite important for this season to hit the right notes in terms of restoring people's faith that these all newbie seasons could really perform well. And maybe if this season had flopped, it would have been one of the last all newbie seasons. I think if the reviews for the season, if the ratings here were not good, then you could have seen, you know, 29, 30, 31 going down the line, a lot more just random returning players sprinkled in here and there just to try and energize the fan base again. So I think it was important that the season did well, and it just absolutely hit it out of the park.
I totally agree with that, and we will certainly momentarily be getting to what makes it all so great, but I do want to quickly say that while I completely agree that knowing what we know now about how every subsequent Survivor season has played out, particularly this season, I would guess will stand out as pretty historically significant in most people's memories, the all winners season, everything that has gone down post Kaguya-an with particularly Tony and Sarah is going to be really interesting to get into now with the full benefit of hindsight. And there's plenty along the way, by the way, about others, Cass in particular, Spencer. There are many, many things that in retrospect are going to age either hilariously or ironically or weirdly, and it's going to be a ton of fun for sure. But I do think it is worth noting for the record that even prior to Winners at War being a thought in anyone's mind, and frankly, prior to season 31, Cambodia being a thought in anyone's mind, I do believe that by the end of Kaguya-an, at the very least, it was already, just even without knowing how historically significant it would become, already regarded as one of the best seasons ever, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think if you ask people in 2014, that would have been the consensus for sure.
Okay, and I think that's right. Please certainly correct me, not only there, but anywhere along the way, if I'm getting things of that nature totally wrong, because that is certainly on the table. But in just rewatching the premiere, and I will say I rewatched many episodes of Kaguya-an relatively recently, as it was becoming clear that Tony and Sarah were going to be a big focal point on season 40 as well, when we were covering that as it was airing. There are some things about Kaguya-an that I feel like really stand out on rewatches compared to a lot of the more modern seasons, Dom. And I will go with your definition of modern there. First and foremost, I think it is really refreshing, and weirdly, the comparison that comes to mind for me along these lines is Survivor Borneo, where it is a cast full of people very clearly kind of self-interested, but not entirely sure what's even going on a lot of the time. And also, perhaps even far more importantly to me, there is no glowing winner slash hero kind of edit. I guess the closest thing is Spencer, but even he, I would say, doesn't really fall anything close to in line with the Ben Driebergens and Rick Devons kind of treatment that we've seen so many people, you know, Tommy recently, and then I think Tony 3.0 could potentially be in that same kind of mix. It is such a refreshing change of pace, even knowing how it goes, to just be watching a season where there aren't necessarily hyper main characters in every sense of the word. Like, obviously Tony's going to get a ton of screen time, but up until the very, very end, I don't think he was on many people's radars like a serious winner contender. I think he was more of a big character kind of focal point in most people's minds. So that aspect, I thought, is something that the show needs a lot more of, and is potentially one of the reasons Kageyan really stands out in retrospect, because it, along the way, was presented so much differently than I think most modern seasons are.
Yeah, I remember back as we were watching this live, when I was knee-deep in Edric at the time, and we would talk about the edit a lot on the podcast, and we weren't putting it in its own little sandbox back then, so that was kind of crossing the stream with the game analysis. We would come in here every single week and just be baffled as to what was going on, and I think we ricocheted around a few different winner candidates over the course of the season. I was convinced that LJ was going to take it down for the longest time, and then upon his blindside, I had to rethink everything. There were a lot of strong Sarah believers up until, you know, the merge episode, at which point that all came crashing down, and then you kind of had to scratch your head and think, okay, well, is this just the most obvious hero edit for Spencer that we've ever seen, but there are a few things lacking there, and maybe he's the guy who has this amazing underdog story and comes up just short. I guess in theory it could be Tony, but of course it can't be Tony, right? Like, how could this madman ever actually win this game? And if he does, how do you even portray that coherently on the screen? So then even as late as, like, when we get down to the final three in the finale, I'm thinking, well, is Wu going to win the season? And then Wu wins that final challenge, and then he takes Tony, and I'm stunned, and I'm thinking, well, maybe this is how it ends. Maybe Tony loses to Wu, you know, and then up and we get to that final tribal council, and Tony is getting raked over the coals by the jury. And I'm thinking, this is really happening. And so up until, like, we're actually reading the votes for Tony to win, I'm convinced that Wu is going to steal this season. And that's the ending that we should have been looking for this whole time. And then suddenly Tony wins and my whole universe just explodes. And I have no idea what to believe anymore. All that I know is I know nothing.
That is the exact thing I was about to say, is I had no memory of this until you were going into that kind of backstory. But I absolutely now remember that our big takeaway, and we probably said this an annoying number of times during, like, San Juan del Sur, was after Kageyan, all we know now is that we know nothing, which was a huge change of pace on the heels of Kim being the obvious standout, and then Malcolm and Denise being the obvious standouts, and Cochran and Tyson. Tony being the winner here set us, it kind of hit the reset button, I guess, for us in a lot of ways. And then it took us until at least late post-merge to really get on the Natalie Anderson bandwagon. But even as we were starting to believe in Natalie, I remember we would just reiterate constantly, all we know, frankly, is that we know nothing, and absolutely anything is still on the table based on what we saw just play out with Tony. And then, of course, Mike Holloway rolls around, and Jeremy Collins and Michelle roll around. And, of course, now all we know is that we know everything until Ken McNichol comes along.
So that took some interesting twists and turns along the way. Also, I think the fact that typically the most interesting moments just in the dark in a Survivor season, some of the big talking points are the premiere episode, the merge episode, and the finale. And usually if the premiere episode is kind of a dud, then it's maybe hard to generate interest in the season, and it takes a while to kind of ease people into it. The merge episode, you really want that one to hit the right note, and then you can have a great season, but then if the finale falls flat, then that's the last thing that most people remember, and it's maybe a sour note to end the season on. One thing that I think this season does, more so than basically any other, and I'm curious if there are any that come to mind for you that also fit this description, I think this season nailed each one of those three most important episodes, where this premiere that we're talking about, this was sensational. In real time, I remember back when, this was when live tweeting was a much more popular thing to do. I know both for us and just for the Survivor fan base in general. And we were all aghast. It's like, what the hell just happened? What did we just watch? And we had so much fun coming in here to break all of that down, just breathlessly trying to dissect and make sense of everything that had happened. And then that Mojo episode, I still go back from time to time and just watch a clip of that tribal council where just all this chaos is happening. And then Sarah kind of plays her way out, and knowing what will become of Sarah in the context of Survivor, that moment takes on a whole new significance, and that episode does as well. And then that finale, where again, after a crazy season where there had been so much to talk about every single week, somehow yet again it still surprised us for the biggest and best surprise of them all.
This is certainly high on the list for me for greatest premiere nights of all time, even at the expense of one of the guys I was rooting for going into the season. I have historically described, and I think would stand by, the Kageyan merge as my single favorite episode in the history of Survivor. Just the most going on, all the moving parts of that tribal council, like both the idols getting played, but then they were on the wrong level, but then cast flipped. Like, it's truly like an episode of The Genius, Dom, which is high praise from me, especially for an episode of Survivor. And then, yeah, I mean, all the way down to the wire in that finale. I certainly remember our penultimate podcast of the season. We were in here talking about how, I guess, that visit into the village where he got to go hang out with the little kids was Wu's big coming out party, and someone is going to win immunity at Final Four, and Spencer's going to be the obvious target if it's not him, and then Wu is probably going to win that last challenge and make the easiest decision in Survivor history. Actually, I guess we probably would have anticipated it being, potentially at least anticipated it being a final three, but even if we knew it was a final two, I'm positive we were talking about Wu as the heavy, heavy front runner to win the game entering that finale. And I will absolutely acknowledge that on finale night, I don't even know if I was open about this in the moment, but a friend was over at my place and we were watching it. And after Wu won the final immunity challenge, we were literally ready. Like, he was in the living room setting up the board. We were about to stop watching the Survivor finale and go play backgammon because the results seemed so obvious from that point forward. And I said, let me just make sure that Tony is about to get voted out. And when Probst flipped that vote over for Cass, I lost my mind. And that must have been at, like, whatever, 9:15 or 10:15, what, 9:15, I guess, which is, as far as I remember, one of the latest points into any season in Survivor history that I've had that kind of shock.
Yeah, it's been interesting watching. There was a Reddit thread recently about people's reaction to Kageyan in the moment. Like, who did people think was going to win as they were watching? And a few people, of course, had to chime in and say that, well, I binged the whole thing after it aired, and it seemed to me like it was a Tony coronation the whole time. And I don't understand what universe those people were living in, but part of the fun of this is I may learn what that universe looks like during the course of this rewatch. And the fact that some people can see an outcome, yeah, like they feel that they're tied to the train tracks just seeing this coming towards them. And for the rest of us, we're just blissfully ignorant. That's part of the fun of this. That's what makes this an interesting puzzle to try and unpick season after season. And there have definitely been times in our careers where, we have just been laser focused on one person being a surefire bet to win the season from very early on. And lots of people saying we were insane. Sometimes we were insane and sometimes we nailed it. And I would not want it to be all of one or all of the other, because it just wouldn't be as exciting anymore. So I guess I salute the people who were able to see through the mist and identify that Tony was going to run away with this thing. I was not one of those. And I think that me not realizing that made this season so much more exciting. It's like, well, okay, all of these antics from Tony are fascinating and fun to watch, but where's the beef? What is this going to amount to? Because if what we're seeing is Tony just gets voted out at final three, which that surprised final two, by the way, that also is a big element of the season, which as it comes closer, we should talk about, because we hadn't had that since Token Chains, I believe. And then that in itself was a twist that was like a reversal to the norm. So that by itself, you know, it's kind of like the way nowadays where like, you know, Trump can say something just like completely batshit insane and absurd, and it just rolls off you like water because there were so many things like that on any given day. With this season, it's, yeah, okay, of course there's a felony. Like, why wouldn't there be? You know, there's a Tyler Perry super idol. There's all of this stuff going on. This is just one more thing on the list. We'll add it on there and we'll just take it for granted. But that was a fundamental change where, like, if this is a final three, then I think all of Tony's endgame plans have to work around that instead. And so all of that's different. So all the stuff going on. And yeah, like you, I thought until most of the finale was already over that the outcome was still up for grabs, which is not something you really ever get nowadays. And when it does, it's almost more surprising because you were so fixed in your mind that, of course, something else was going to happen.
For sure. And you are totally right about all of the kind of weird things that go into this season, and we will certainly address them along the way as they come up. But the first thing is the theme where they're split into three tribes, first of all, three small tribes instead of two big tribes, Brains versus Beauty versus Brawn. You know, you mentioned there's going to be the Tyler Perry idol that comes along later on. There's a swap in here. There's a lot going on, and then of course on top of all of that you have just Tony's mere presence on a season is going to make it inherently haywire for as long as he's out there. But I would say, Dom, that as far as I'm concerned, and of course this is completely counterfactual and who knows what it would have been like under other circumstances, but for my money I feel like this cast was just so solid that it almost didn't matter what they did with them. It was going to be awesome.
Yeah, this has, I would say, maybe the best all-newbie cast of all time, and certainly one of the deepest as well. Like, it's not just like you have the, you know, the top shelf is great, and then everything below that, you're kind of fighting for scraps. This was a great cast, but also a deep cast, where you look down the final six, all of them except for Trish, who a lot of people would say was robbed of a spot on a returning player season. Get her in there to mix things up. You know, you have Tony, Wu, Cass, Spencer, and Tasha all coming back. All, I guess, like, Wu's returning appearance, like, doesn't stick in your memory that much, but even that had some interesting moments with, like, him trying to turn the tables on Spencer or vice versa, and then Cass somehow reinventing herself in that season too. And then, of course, later in Cambodia, you have Spencer and Tasha as these tremendously pivotal players making their way to the final three together. And that relationship is one that I'm really keen to track over the course of this season as well. In addition to, you know, Tony and Sarah, Spencer and Cass, all these different permutations. So you have five of the final six players coming back, making a bigger name for themselves. And then also as you keep going down the line, of course, Sarah as the merge boot, but also like Bryce, for example, as the third boot on the season, may have milked more attention out of that finish than any other third boot in the history of reality TV. So I honestly still not a fan of Bryce, I would say, but respect the hustle on that one. Like, honestly, world class in that department. And then, you know, Garrett, we were so excited and pumped up about Garrett coming in as this guy who had reached out to us, had let us know that he, in the course of his 2,000 hours of preparation, like, he listened to our stuff and really enjoyed it, really respected the way that we thought about the game. So we were pumped to see if all of that preparation could pay off for him. And then he goes out in one of the best, I would say, single episode meltdowns of in the history of Survivor. And that's part of what makes this premiere so tremendously entertaining. And then, you know, Jatia, of course, who could possibly forget, and just all of this other stuff going on that keeps the season interesting at basically every point.
And I mean, I think LJ could have been in the mix to return. I think Morgan could have been in the mix to return. I wouldn't have been surprised to see.
Well, I would have been surprised to see that. LJ, of course, you know, should have been on several other seasons by now. Should have been on the all winner season. maybe not a winner of Survivor, but the winner of my heart. But we don't need to relitigate that one.
Okay.
There'll be a lot of time for that.
Point is, I totally agree that this is one of the deepest, if not the deepest, cast of newbies ever. And I do want to just roll the clip of the very first introduction package, because I'm guessing for a lot of the listeners out there, it's going to be at least similar to what it was like for me, getting to hear from these people all over again, just knowing this is day one for them of what is going to become probably like a defining experience of their life in a lot of these cases. So I do want to just play the beginning of the opening montage here, because I'm not going to compare it to the choppers descending on heroes versus villains, but it was at least in the next tier down for me. I thought this was a lot of fun. So let's listen to this again.
Once again, Survivor is taking television's greatest social experiment in a new direction. These 18 Americans have been divided into three groups that represent the qualities they most rely on in their daily lives. The Brain Tribe. With an average IQ of 130, this group utilizes their intellect to accomplish their goals.
In 2010, I entered the World Open Chess Tournament and I tied for first. I certainly don't look diabolical or like a genius, both of which I am.
I'm president of the Miami Marlins. In baseball, there's only one winner at the end. Survivor is the same. So I've been playing this game for a long time, just not on a beach.
I am an attorney, and my track record is undefeated. They're thinking, oh, how cute, there's the mom. They don't know I'm probably more cunning and ruthless than 95% of the population.
The Beauty Tribe. This group includes a cheerleader, pageant queen, and fashion model who rely on their looks to get what they want.
I was an NFL cheerleader. I don't want to sound like super conceited, but from a guy, I usually get what I want.
I'm a fashion model. I think it's going to help me out get a little bit further into the game, because I'm going to win them over with my looks.
I competed in Miss Kentucky. I was second place 3 years in a row. People label me pageant girl, but I believe that beauty is going to help me with the social aspect of the game.
The Brawn Tribe. This group relies on physical strength.
My name is Cliff Robinson. I played 18 years in the NBA. I always play for bread and meat. I don't win, I don't eat. That's what the game of Survivor is about.
I'm a police officer, and I started mixed martial arts in 2009. Getting paid to punch someone in the face, it doesn't really get better than that.
I've been a police officer up in Jersey City for 13 years. I'm always jumping over cars, climbing over fences, jumping from roof to roof, chasing people. So this game to me should be easy. Knock on wood.
So yeah, as you mentioned, a lot of eventual days of Survivor are going to be played by a lot of the voices that you just heard there. And one thing I want to say right off the top of the podcast here, Dom, is one of the people who really stood out for me early on, and I'm dying to know how much of this is because at the time of this recording, we are still dealing with all that is going on with COVID-19. And I have gone from spending pretty much all day, every day, more or less, surrounded by people with Boston accents to never hearing Boston accents anymore. And it, like, warmed my heart just hearing Trish. And I do wonder how much of that is just fond memories of Trish and how much of that is just the accent.
See, I would have thought there would be some deep-seated, like, Maine-Boston rivalry, but it sounds like that's not the case. It sounds like these are actually your people.
I mean, Maine is desperate to be just acknowledged by Boston as part of that culture. But to be fair, I live not far outside of Boston anymore. But yeah, I do definitely, I want to say, have many, many fond memories of Trish, and she is someone I'm really excited to get to revisit here for the first time in too long. But that really stood out to me as like, oh man, I didn't anticipate being that overcome with joy just hearing Trish's speaking voice again. But that was a lot of fun. And then I also wanted to say one of my early takeaways, and I anticipate this just becoming a stronger and stronger held view, a more and more strongly held view in my mind, is now that I know how everything's gonna play out and it doesn't negatively affect a lot of the people that I'm rooting for while watching a season in real time. I think I have underrated Cass as a character on Survivor before. I stand by a lot of the things that I have previously felt about her acumen in a lot of areas of the game, but just as a character and as a genuine agent of chaos, she is in the complete tier one Hall of Fame category for me.
I stand by my claim that Cass belonged on the Beauty Tribe over Morgan, but again, all the time in the world to revisit that as we we get through the season here. What did you make? Just complete silence, not even going to play ball or acknowledge that one?
I had already told myself not to bring that up.
Out of, you know, just for my own sake, or what?
I don't see how that conversation goes well for me.
Well, sure. Speaking of conversations that won't go well, our first introduction to Sarah is her saying that the best part of being a cop is that she gets paid to punch people in the face, which maybe has aged less well than everything else on this season. But we will get our first introduction to someone who I did not flag up at the time to be really any kind of serious Survivor player.
Are we sure she wasn't talking about being a UFC fighter in that comment?
Could go both ways, honestly. That may be the more charitable interpretation.
I don't know. I don't remember, but I could see that being possible.
Yeah. Honestly, would not be surprised to hear that out of the mouth of most cops either. So, you know, that's the way that goes.
The fact that we even have to wonder is kind of the point here.
Right, but so at the time, Sarah was one of the big preseason favorites, and that was where I think I first, I don't know if you were on that train at the time as well, but I remember saying in our preseason coverage that, like, I don't get it. I don't see what everyone else sees in her. And it was to the point where after the first few episodes, I was sincerely concerned, coming off of Blood vs. Water, which was very heavily spoiled, and Karamoan as well, that maybe this season is spoiled again and Sarah is going to make a deep run, or she's going to win, because the level of hype had reached such a point, and it didn't seem at all commensurate with anything that we saw on the show. And so I was just like here scratching my chin thinking, well, is the outcome of the season already ruined for me? Have I basically figured out what it was, because people won't let me remain ignorant of that? As it turns out, you know, Sarah is a fantastic Survivor player, and we saw her show that on Game Changers on Winners at War. I'm going to be intrigued to see over this rewatch if the signs of that were actually there and I didn't see them at the time, or if I was right to maybe be skeptical and it was only in her later appearances that she did show what she was capable of.
It's possible you'll be able to find Sarah's pregame footage on YouTube or elsewhere still, because I would imagine that is mostly what people were reacting to, or like interviews with Dalton or Gordon or whatever. But yeah, I would imagine Sarah, just thinking about how I kind of loosely remember or would imagine these people came across in kind of pregame interviews, I would guess Sarah would have stood out to me as someone to be more optimistic about, at least early on, although I would kind of caution against necessarily reading too much into the Sarah that we actually get to see in the episodes. Just knowing how things are going to go for her on this season, I do not know if painting her in the most flattering or most honest light was necessarily a priority compared to setting her up for that big downfall.
Yeah, and you did say that this is a season where, I would say with the exception of Spencer, you don't really have anyone who has this unvarnished hero edit, and I don't think you could give Tony that if you wanted to. This isn't going to be a Redemption Island-style coronation, even if you had some like fierce Tony partisans in the editing room. But I think it is fun that you get to see all of these players who show these like glimmers of genius, who also just go down in flames at various points as well. So yeah, maybe we are going to see signs of the potential that Sarah would display to the tune of $1 million and came very close to 2 million more as well. But then also we get that merge episode where maybe that joins Garrett in the list of single episode meltdowns over the course of Survivor. And that's in the space of one season, and we're already adding to that list still.
Yeah, going to be a lot to unpack, I'm positive, along the way. about Sarah here, and a lot of it coming up quickly as we get into her trying to deduce whether or not Tony is a cop. That is one of the most interesting exchanges out of this whole premiere that we are allegedly here to be talking about today, Dom. But let's get into the introductions here as everyone shows up on the mat, because this is one of the most exciting, as far as I'm concerned, and impactful first several minutes of a season. For whatever reason, it seems like it became really fashionable. I guess it would have started in Cambodia when they wanted to recreate the Borneo marooning, and a lot of seasons around this time were doing the race around on the boat and gather all your supplies as the intro to the season. Here in Cagayan, all the teams show up on their mats, and right away, Jeff does some introductory things, gets to know people, sets up the theme in the most hilarious way imaginable by they all show up and are in their groups already. He explains that it's brains versus beauty versus brawn, and then just so happens to land on Morgan, which tribe do you think you guys are? Like, just so clearly setting her up for, like, the ultimate reverse free roll of having to acknowledge, obviously, we're the beauty tribe here.
You get Spencer, like, shadowing in the shadow of Cliff Robinson being asked, okay, so Spencer, are you the brain tribe or the brawn tribe? Or what do you think?
Call your shot. Yeah, but right away, instead of just a marooning and then everyone's off to camp, we have an immediate decision point and kind of mechanic within the game for multiple people here on each tribe, for everyone, really, but then specifically for a couple others in more in-depth. Yeah, go ahead.
And just on that, this introduction is, as you say, very minimalist. We don't get some, like, long, elaborate sequence. All it is they're riding on the trucks through the jungle, and we close up on a few different faces, and they all say their piece, and then we're smack bang in the middle of things, and we there's no dilly dallying here. They know that they have a ton to get from this premiere. They're not short for material by any means, and so we just get right to that. And I would actually be surprised if the word Cagayan is said over the course of the season. Jeff always refers to it as brains versus beauty versus brawn that I can remember. And this is before the days where every season was shot in Fiji, so we were jumping around locations, and then sometimes Survivor would stay in the same filming location for a two-season block. So I think this was maybe the same place as Blood vs. Water had been. Either way, though, the actual location of the season is really irrelevant to what happens there. It is just a backdrop, and there's no kind of cultural tie-in, really. And even later on, when Rue visits the local village, that could honestly be any visit to a local village on Survivor for the most part. There's really nothing to separate the location of the season from any of its predecessors or successors. So in that respect, you know, that is the one department where this season maybe falls down. But as long as you have, like, a good looking, like, lush, natural backdrop or whatever, it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things.
I am 85% confident Cagayan is the Philippines. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Didn't realize that I wasn't certain where this actually was until you flagged that up. But yeah, I think that kind of speaks to your point, is it's almost irrelevant where this season takes place. But yeah, let's get into these decisions that have to get made here. The whole tribe has to come together to select a leader among the six of them. And we wind up with LJ for the beauty tribe, Sarah for the brawn tribe, and David Sampson for the brains tribe. And right away then, every leader has to select the weakest member of their tribe, and whoever they pick is gonna be singled out and potentially removed from the game. But I don't think literally anyone thought that was in play. They just have to make a public declaration with the understanding that Jeff has asked for the weakest person, and interpret that however you may be so inclined. We see LJ pick Morgan, we see Sarah pick Trish, and we see David Sampson immediately and almost proudly pick Garrett to be the weakest person on the brains tribe. And for anyone with a hazy memory of this season, I'm going to put Garrett at 6'2", 210 pounds of pure muscle. This is one of the most shredded people Survivor has ever seen. And unapologetically, when asked about this decision, David says to Jeff, and in front of the whole group, he's already looking at the end game here. So within the first 10 minutes, Dom, we are off to a much, much more electric start than virtually any other season that I can think of. And it's going to pay off immensely down the line in the form of this second boot in this premiere night that is going to leave Twitter so aghast here. And it is purely because of just the producers making a good decision and giving the players more chances to mess up strategically.
Yeah, and you would just assume automatically, if David's doing this, it must be because he knows what's coming. He knows how these things tend to go. He's seen the great legacy of Sandy Bergen and Sierra Reid and friends from Token Jeans, and he knows if you are being asked to nominate a weakling or to vote someone out, yeah, there's got to be some twist involved. They're not just going to axe three people in an 18-person cast right out of the gates. And so maybe if there's going to be a challenge, let's say, or there's going to be some opportunity to do something, maybe you enlist your actual strongest player to help out with that. That might be a smart heads-up move, but then you need to find some kind of way to justify that. And so I was expecting to hear some kind of a hastily contrived justification for how, well, Garrett's actually the weakest, or some way to like paper over that, when in reality he's setting the tribe up for success. Turns out none of that is true, and David is just openly gunning for his biggest competition right from day one.
Right. I mean, the idea of picking Garrett is not crazy at all, especially if you have already seen that Morgan and Trish have been selected by the other tribe, and you can just say, whatever's about to happen, it is not the three of them being removed from the game, and I just want my man Garrett here to hold it down for the team and whatever these three are going to go off and do. And instead, he is saying, I'm thinking about the end game already, and I know Garrett's going to be a problem for me. And Garrett has an hilarious confessional about it, where he says something to the effect of, at least the other leaders pretended they were so sad to have to pick the people, but David didn't even hesitate. He just patted me on the back and said I was the weakest. And right away, it's going to have a pretty heavy impact on what those three weakest people end up choosing to do, where I think somewhat understandably in that spot, Garrett is feeling a bit on the outs, at least as far as one person on his team is concerned. And he knows the other five are about to be together while he's isolated from the group. So when he gets to camp and finds out that each of these people who were selected as the weakest have a choice to make between taking extra rice for the team or foregoing the extra rice and getting an idol clue to go look for an idol themselves, Garrett right away is happy to take the idol clue and proudly doesn't even consider taking the rice for the team. Morgan also seems to feel similarly to Garrett there, whereas Trish took this as an opportunity to gain her footing back that she felt like she had potentially lost with the group and wasn't really taking being selected the weakest personally. And maybe that was because of Sarah Lucina's phenomenal social game or whatever, but I did think the disparity there was really interesting, and yet again only possible because the producers gave the players an option here to make a mistake or improve their spot.
Yeah, I really hope we get a good phenomenal in the wild this season from Sarah. But if there is a constant of this episode, it is just every single member of the Brains tribe talking about how stupid the other Brains are. And this is and so one of the undercurrents for this whole season is Spencer becomes this underdog, this massive fan favorite. You have people hyping him up, saying he's played one of the best games they've ever seen. I think in one of the ROJP polls taken like shortly after the season, he was listed as like one of the top 10 players to never win or something.
I think it was of all time. I think he was like number 13 of all time.
Yeah, and I remember despite Spencer like reaching out to us and me as well before the season, being like, hey, I really appreciate your guys' coverage, and like we had kind of pledged our allegiance to him on that basis, I found myself coming in here every single week saying, I don't get what the hype is about yet. Like, I think Spencer's doing his best, and maybe he's a bit hot-headed at times or whatever, but I don't get where all of this gushing praise is coming from. And I don't know how well he took that, but also no one else seemed to take it that well either. It's like a lot of people were kind of pushing back on that, and I found myself just like this lone voice in the wind. But I'm almost more sympathetic to those people now, having watched this premiere, where the season really does get off to this footing of Spencer is just like this seemingly sensible, like mild-mannered kid who is doing what you do on Survivor. Like, he's making alliances, he's doing his best to win challenges, he's having these normal strategic conversations in private, Garrett, because that's what you do on Survivor. And everyone else is just acting like a massive idiot and just watching as everything else burns down around them. In some cases, the rice is literally burning down around them, because Dratia does not take her exit well, which she was informed of, because, again, just bad practice on Survivor. Don't tell someone you're voting them out, even if they should probably know if they're paying attention. So everyone else on this brain tribe is just punting off left and right, and Spencer seems like the one guy who really has a good head on his shoulders. So I'm almost more sympathetic to that now than I was back at the time. So it's interesting to kind of work my way into that mindset.
Yeah, I think I was probably, if memory serves, a bit more in the pro-Spencer camp along the way here. But I do think it is worth acknowledging that he did have, as far as I was concerned, a really good premiere here at the very least. And I will recognize that based on the way the season is going to play out, they have a lot of incentive to make Spencer look good and not necessarily look bad along the way. And they certainly exercise that freedom, I'm sure, from time to time. But I thought he did a really good job when Jeff tried to ambush him with the, Spencer, which tribe do you think you guys are? I thought, well, I guess we're the nerds was a pretty good response there. And then later in the second tribal council, when Garrett gets voted out after Jatia has dumped out the entire tribe's food supply, that is a spot where I'm guessing a lot of people, particularly those who have just been totally blindsided, would be quite susceptible to losing their cool and lashing out. And I think a lot of people may think Spencer in particular would be the type to be like, "Ugh, what's wrong with you guys? That's clearly not in your best interest. What are you doing?" Whereas Spencer himself just laughs and says, "All right, well, who wants to welcome me to the bottom?" Those both really stood out to me as like super optimal answers there. So I definitely would guess that I was a bit more of a Spencer defender than it sounds like you necessarily were back.
Well, I will say too that it would be a bold call for Jatia to show up wearing the I Love Nerds t-shirt if she wasn't on the brain
side. Yes.
That's some cross-tribal fraternization there that we need to clamp down on.
Yes, that would have been quite an ambitious move to try to work on so some cross-tribal alliances that early on into the game. But Dom, let's get into, I suppose, Garrett is the one person who was selected as the weakest who ends up coming away here with the hidden immunity idol right away. Fantastic start for him. Nowhere to go. or I guess nowhere to go but down is accurate here, and down it will go pretty quickly, but seemed promising for at least a few minutes there. I did want to highlight one quote that pops up as far as things are concerned here when Trish reveals to her tribe that she was faced with the decision of either getting more rice or having an idle clue for herself. She tells them she got more rice and everyone's really excited. Let's take a listen to what Tony had to say about that decision.
Because I was already seen as being the weakest, I felt like that's what they were going to come to camp thinking, that this older, skinny woman that we eliminated is weak. So I had to get myself right back on equal terms with all of them. I actually had the opportunity to go and look for the idol, but I went to the group and got the extra bag of rice.
I know you would.
I was the captain!
As soon as we arrived to camp, Trish came with open arms. She says, "I had the choice of looking for the idol for myself or helping my tribe out and getting a second bag of rice." And we were like so excited. We were like, "Yes, you did the right thing." But if I was in Trish's shoes, there would only have been one bag of rice and one idol in my pocket. All right, so who wants to start building shelter?
And a lot of things are going to stand out about Tony along the way, but I thought that was one of the more hilarious ones, just knowing what we know now about all of his idol shenanigans and so forth, other various shenanigans along the way. Dom, let's get into, at this point, I think this is a good transition into Tony, the construction worker, and this lie that he's going to tell his tribe. What do you think about that now, obviously knowing that it's not going to last long and it's going to be remembered as one of the more hilarious kind of things Tony tried to pull off and is going to be a running joke for a lot of Tony's career? What did you think about this whole construction worker scene now in the year 2020?
It is amazing how amateurish his attempt to defend that lie is with Sarah, where it's like, no, how would I know that that's what cops do? How would you know that? And it's like, well, Tony, because she's a cop, right? Like, let's put two and two together here. Like, he is so wolfy about it that I think this is where, like, this creates this indelible first impression of Tony that it's really hard to move past, where after already being a little sketchy about his prospects in the preseason, we come in here and Sarah immediately clocks him just like that, and he should be able to tell at that point, like, the jig is up. There's no way he can maintain this for much longer, and yet he's just furiously backpedaling or just, like, pedaling around in circles and then flying off the handle of his bike, and it's utterly shambolic. But I do wonder how different Survivor history would have been if Sarah had just not given him that second chance, if he hadn't made an effort to correct that mistake as well, because her confessional immediately in the moment is, you know, I can tell Tony's a cop. He wouldn't come clean with me. I don't trust him. And then she goes on to say later that in the premiere that, you know, Tony banged his foot on the challenge because he's a dumbass. So first impressions of Tony, not great, as it turns out. But this will become a match made in heaven before too long.
Yes, I want to momentarily roll the audio here of Sarah and Tony and their first interaction about who's a cop and who's not. And then when we get to the part later on down the line where he does come clean, hopefully we remember to roll the audio there as well, because Tony and Sarah both being cops, I think we'll go on to, like, borderline define the bond between them and have an enormous, enormous effect on the eventual kind of all winners season. So let's roll the clip of that now.
I've been a cop for quite a while, and there is a look that cops have, and Tony's got it.
If I'm wrong, he should go be a cop because he looks just like one.
Will you look at me real quick? Will you be honest with me?
Uh-huh.
Are you a cop?
No, why?
You swear?
I swear.
You look like a cop.
I could be a cop if you want. Why?
You swear you're not?
I swear. Why? I wouldn't hide that.
What do you do?
Construction. Tiles.
Yeah?
That's my main thing, but I do roofing too. Jersey City.
You look like a cop. You look like...
I have a tattoo here. They don't allow that.
How do you know?
I have plenty of cop friends. You don't know no cops?
No, I do know cops.
I have, like, maybe 50 friends that are cops. I thought for a split second, should I tell them I'm a cop? Then I said, nah, you know what?
If I tell them I'm a police officer, the first thing they're going to be thinking is, like, this guy's strategical, he's tactical, he's probably sharp on his toes, he's very observant, and they're going to be right. So obviously I'm a threat to them, so they're going to probably want to try to blindside me right away.
What do you do, Sarah?
I'm a cop.
Are you really a cop?
Yeah. Interview and interrogation are my daily duties, and I get lied to every day at work, you know? And there's just something that makes me feel uneasy about Tony.
You're a pretty cool girl, Sarah. You know what? I got a confession to make. Want me to tell you the truth?
Yeah.
I'm not a cop.
You're lying to me.
I'm not.
You are a cop.
I thought you were going to say I'm a cop. Nah, get out of here.
Yeah, just tell me you're a cop.
Come on.
I don't know what the hell he does. All I know is I don't think I can trust him, so he's got to go as soon as possible. That's all I got to say.
So I did think that was worth having people remember the specifics of for the historical record, just because the two of them both being cops and that dynamic is really fascinating. And I'm looking forward to when we get to the part where they finally get on the same page and end up being able to sincerely bond over it, because I do really feel like that similarity is going to go on to be one of the truly defining kind of elements of the history of Survivor, frankly. So definitely putting a pin in that and returning to it later. Dom, I will also say I'm disappointed to have Googled this and found out that shambolic is actually a word and not a reference to just Shambo being crazy.
Yes, as of all pertaining to Shambo. Honestly, we need a word like that so I can use that one more often. Maybe Shambo-esque, Shamboian. I don't know. Answers on a postcard for that one. But one thing I do want to draw attention to with Tony in this early stage of his first season is just how bulky he is, where, like, Tony is jacked at this point. Tony could very easily pass as a cop, as a construction worker, whereas you look at even his preseason press photos for Winners at War, there's always a big difference between day one and day 39 if you're lucky enough to make it that far. But Tony in Winners at War, he looks kind of old and haggard almost, you know? He's past his prime. Tony in this season, you know, he's jacked. You can tell why he belongs on that Brawn tribe. And what happens is Tony said he contracted a parasite in this first season, which when he got back, he was bedridden for a while, and that it dealt lasting damage that he's never actually been able to fully recover from. And so that's why you see, you know, you look at Tony day one here versus Tony day 39 here. It's like night and day. It's a dramatic difference. But then Tony day one, day 39, Winners of War is much less so. And even, you know, Tony day 39 here versus Tony day one on either of his other seasons doesn't actually look all that much different either.
You know, you hear about dad strength, but it does seem like as soon as Tony became a dad, he just lost all of his strength.
Right.
Yeah. So I also don't want to skip over something that we saw over on the Beauty Tribe in our intro to them. A couple of things here, actually. First of all, we have a team, I believe our only team this season, although this may change in an upcoming episode, but at least to this point, the only team this season that is able to make fire without flint, which it seems like is becoming an increasingly standard thing on the more modern seasons. But it continues to amaze me that it took up until, I think it was Boston Rob on Heroes versus Villains, and then again on Redemption Island, and Malcolm could do it on Philippines, and now most people, or at least many people, can show up at least roughly familiar with the idea of making fire just using sticks. It blew me away for so long that was the case, that it took that long for it to become more or less standard, until I realized it probably would have been so much more difficult to figure out how to get that sort of thing done until, like, the age of just infinite YouTube tutorials. So it does kind of make sense that it wasn't until 2009, 2010-ish that this was a common practice on Survivor.
Yeah, that's the practice regimen back then. Is you finish watching a season of Survivor on the Stentalizer playlist, yeah, and then you open a new tab and you watch a grainy YouTube tutorial about how to make fire with flint.
That is the exact preparation back in the day. So, Dom, another thing over on the Beauty Tribe worth noting here is our first official alliance of the season, it seems like, is your guy, Bryce. And I say that apparently ironically, not the biggest Bryce fan, it sounds like, is Dom, but I will be on the right side of history there and say I am a big Bryce believer. So he and Morgan are going to make the first alliance, that at least that we see on screen here, ostensibly as kind of a proactive measure against the other four, who seem quite likely to come together on the Beauty Tribe, potentially doing so, although, as it's going to turn out, not much they can do about it if the other four decide they want to go that route.
Right, and this is a case where in a tribe of six people, the basic arithmetic, you kind of run into a brick wall at some point, where if you just don't get off on the right foot with even just one person, that's actually potentially a big problem. But if that person has other people that they're well connected to, or if you're trying to get a group of three or four people together, you really have to be on good terms with basically everybody. And you know, it's better than the Brain Tribe, where no one is on good terms with anybody, but it's still not a great start for the beauties to get off to here.
Now, let's move over to the Brains Tribe, where it is genuinely hilarious how unable to get on the same page in virtually any respect this group of people is, especially when it should be pretty straightforward that, hey, if four of us come together, that's going to be a pretty good situation for the foreseeable future here. But we have our intro to Jatia, who's proudly a nuclear engineer, and she's got the whole blueprint figured out for how this shelter is going to get built, and that does not go as planned, and we will certainly see the challenges not go as planned. The food supply is certainly not going to go as planned here, and it never ceases to amaze me, as many times as I rewatch the early episodes of this season. And again, I will grant that there were probably some harmonious times along the way, and they have a lot of incentive to make this tribe look like complete buffoons 24/7. But it is really just incredible how every single person, it seems like, is at least doing a little bit of something to get on the other five's nerves. It is genuinely, it's like an Arrested Development family dynamic where, like, everyone's contributing to the group annoyance in some kind of way.
And even Spencer, who is mostly rising above the fray and doing a good job of that, is yoked to Garrett, who insists on spilling all of the secrets about their alliance and on sticking his own foot in his mouth and trying to jam Spencer's foot in there as well. Like, even though he's doing his best, you have to make alliances early on. That's just good practice on Survivor. We know that those early alliances tend to go the distance. And yeah, if you make it with the wrong person, as seems to have happened here, then that can really land you in some danger early on. But it's not like there's another good candidate for who Spencer should team up with instead, right? Because who is it meant to be? We see him end up in this successful pairing with Tasha in Cambodia, but in the early days of Cagayan, they weren't all that close. And I think that's one of the things Spencer told us in his interview with us for this season, was that they were in the same alliance together, and after a point, and then eventually when they were being whittled down and being picked off, they kind of had to stick together, but they were never super close. And so coming into Cambodia, they were together just because of, well, that's the devil I know versus the devil I don't, and that familiarity often is enough to repair a lot of bridges and just get people on the same page early. And they developed a good bond over time in that season, but in the early days of Cagayan, they are still strangers to each other. They have no affection, no reason to keep each other around. So if that seemed like the most natural pairing, that one's not as easy as it might seem. And then, you know, Jatia, no. Cass, maybe, but as it turns out,
someday.
Definitely not. Perhaps, yeah. David Samson already has one foot out the door. And then Garrett is doing his best to sabotage anyone he comes in contact with. You know, the reverse King Midas approach for Garrett. So there's just no, like, even if you put someone on this tribe who is a good Survivor player, they don't have anything to work with. They're still not going to have a fun time.
I don't think it is the case at all that the beauty team was assembled to actively get up in each other's faces and disagree and talk a bunch of shit. I don't think it was the case that they expected the Brawn tribe to just be all over the place a lot of the time. I think they certainly knew there were some potential fireworks that could emerge there for sure. But any tribe with Woo and Uncle Cliffy, I think, is going to have some, at least a couple of members there that are a bit more drama averse than the average Survivor contestant. But it does genuinely seem to me like at least plausible that this group of six people was put together to not get along, like specifically selected because they would have such a caustic dynamic.
Yeah, this is my my pet conspiracy theory about this, is that even though Jeff himself is a massive Cochrane stan and believer, Cochrane's win is such an aberration in the broad historical arc of Survivor that they really needed to return to form at some point. And so what better way than to have the jocks dunk on the nerds in the greatest possible fashion this season, where, I mean, the jocks don't even need to get involved. Maybe that's the failing here, is the nerds do such a good job of sabotaging themselves that we can't even recreate that classic dynamic here.
I think one thing very much worth remembering kind of along these lines, by the way, is by his own admission, Spencer just acted his way through casting, and he was such a different person once he was actually in the game and knew he had his slot on the show and could just finally be himself again, that Jeff Probst felt compelled to write him a letter of apology for being so far off from what he was expecting. So I think it is very much possible that this tribe wasn't even as much of a disaster as they anticipated, if they thought Spencer was going to be completely off the rails too.
It's almost a letdown. They should have had the belligerent young Republican Spencer, who had a 0.0 chance of winning the game, and instead they got someone who actually seemed pretty composed and measured for the most part.
Yeah.
But even that will fade over time.
Yes. We also, again, to go back to these decisions the producers very wisely let them make at the beginning, forced them, probably is a better way of putting it, to make at the beginning of the game, immediately now have this dynamic between Garrett and David right away pushed to the forefront here, where Garrett's unhappy about being the one who was picked, and David knows that Garrett's not feeling good about him. And one element that I wanted to address there that gets kind of glossed over in the episode, but I do think it is kind of an interesting conversation here, Dom, is David mentioning kind of offhand in a confessional that a big piece of why he's nervous about Garrett is, look, this is the Brains tribe. We've been told you're on here because you're a brain, and Garrett hasn't told us what is giving him that kind of title as far as the producers would be concerned. And that is extremely nerve-wracking for me, that he's not being upfront about whatever it is that has gotten him that label. And I do think it is certainly a place worth deducting a lot of points from Garrett, that he has not at least been able to come up with some sort of excuse for being on the Brains tribe by now, even if it's something completely not unfathomable, but something perhaps a bit tenuous. At the same time, I would acknowledge that being thrust into a position where you are immediately identified as a brain is about as bad as someone like Garrett, who would not necessarily be picked off for such characteristics right away, could draw up. And I think this is something Aubrey talked about as well on Co Wrong.
Yeah, he could try and come up with some, like, James Ryan-esque, I'm just this all-American elementary school teacher kind of shtick, but I don't know how well that's going to fly. But I do think it is important on any game like this to ask yourself, for any given person who's on the cast with you, what's the hook? Why are they there? Like, what did the producers see in them? What archetype were they cast to fill? And sometimes that can lead you in the wrong direction. So, like, Carter, for example, on Philippines, who seemingly there is no good answer to that question. Turns out in casting, apparently he was like a bundle of laughs and was really energetic and jazzed up and just completely retreated into his shell when he got out there. And so, sometimes stuff like that can happen. But for the most part, especially on a season where there are clear labels that are meant to generate this tribal mentality and these clear dividing lines, if there's someone on your Brains tribe who does not seem all that smart, or there's someone on the Beauty tribe who, I guess it's harsher to say, who doesn't seem all that attractive, but just in general, if there is a label and someone doesn't seem to fit the label, then what's going on? That is like a question that is worth exploring for sure.
And not only when there is a label, but I definitely remember Ian Terry, great friend of the podcast, patron of the podcast, currently in Big Brother sequester, not being able to hear these podcasts, but he would did talk about sometime after BB14. I want to say it was potentially during some kind of BB15 coverage, talking about McCray or maybe like Steve Moses years down the line, about that kind of person, probably more specifically on Big Brother, but I think the same could potentially be very true of Survivor as well. The kind of person that a recruiter would not necessarily be rushing to sign up is almost always going to just have some kind of hook that is the reason they were cast. They're never just a person who was asked to be on the show. It is almost 100% of the time going to be either a super fan or some kind of genius within their field, or both potentially. But no matter what it is, other players are right away and probably correctly going to have pretty instinctive kind of reasons to be concerned.
You've been watching ahead for this rewatch more than I have. Do they flag up Spencer as a super fan, or does he really make an emphasis on talking about that himself? Because clearly, in the light of Cochrane, that's you know, that term has really entered the lexicon with a bang. Are we at the point where on every season there is a kind of designated superfan whose job it is to talk about how big a superfan they are over and over and over again? Or are we in that transitional period where there are still superfans on the show, definitely, but they're able to conceal that or not use that as their one major personality trait if they don't want to?
The one instance of Spencer being a superfan that I can readily come up with isn't until the finale where he's trying to pitch to Tony, hey, Jeff didn't say this is the final immunity challenge. We must be playing down to a final two.
And even that is this interesting kind of breaking the fourth wall moment in and of itself.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that logic is, by the way, airtight. And I think that honestly may be something that we anticipated him being able to argue if he made it to that spy. That definitely, I shouldn't say definitely, but I'm pretty sure that came up as something we flagged up as like a hypothetical argument he could make if he found himself in that spot that really should work on Tony. If Tony knew, I think Tony even said, like, I didn't know that he had to be telling me the truth there. And if I did, I might have thought differently about it. But in any case, I don't believe it is like explicitly mentioned. It's certainly not repeatedly like I'm the big super fan along the way. It's just more generally him talking about being really smart and great at chess and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So we end up here, Dom, with a first tribal council that seems pretty clearly to be a David versus Garrett, the original survivor, David versus Goliath situation here. And it's honestly a bit more straightforward than I remember, just because of the premiere night. The second tribal council is the one that really sticks in your memory here. But we do end up seeing that kind of foursome that Garrett had initially tried to bring together actually does work pretty seamlessly for this first vote here. And by a vote of 4-2, we are going to lose David Sampson with Cass as the one person on the outs there. But things are not going to stay this straightforward for too long. Everyone on this team is pretty quickly aware that we have two pretty clear groups of two now going forward, with Cass McQuillan, of all people, in the middle. So things are going to get spicy here pretty quickly. But Dom, give me your, I guess, parting thoughts here on David Sampson.
Exactly what a first boot should be in a season like this, right? Just perfectly skeevy, perfectly overplaying his hand, trying to play 39 Days of Survivor in the space of 39 minutes. Just everything you could ask for to really set the tone for what the season is going to be. So I think great casting choice and great first boot. And maybe it's hard to say inevitable with just how chaotic the season is, but it feels like someone like him should always be an early boot. And it's very fitting that he is in this exact circumstance, I would say. But one thing I do want to ask you is, I think you would agree with me, and most others would as well. Luzon, the Brains tribe, one of the greatest tribes that we've seen in the history of Survivor, that still stands up to this day. Do you think that's easier in a three-tribe format like the one we have on this season? Because we were big evangelists for a long time for having three tribes. We thought it had a good effect on making the game more fluid and dynamic, especially after swaps. And we have kind of rode back on that quite a bit recently, where so often what we see is we have these small starting tribes and then they get whittled down, and then actually it seems to constrict most of what can happen in these like post-swap settings. And I remember when I spoke to Miles Nye on one of the episodes that he and I did together, he made the point, which didn't seem obvious to me at the time, but in retrospect really does, which is that there's actually just a lot less you can do when you have three tribes, not just in terms of space and logistics and so on, but just the kind of things that work in that like adversarial challenge setting. Some of them just don't scale all that well to three tribes. So like a tug of war, for instance, you know, that just there are lots of challenges which are just automatically off the table if you're starting your season with three tribes. But also in terms of what it does to the game, to the editing and so on, it really does feel like every single time there are two tribes that get the majority of the focus, and then one tribe is just also kind of there, and every episode we have to make the obligatory visit over there to see what's going on, but we're not too happy about it. And so in Philippines, that was Calabar. In in this season, I would say that's the Beauty Tribe so far. And the Beauty Tribe was never going to easily get a fair hearing, I think, just because, firstly, you know, if it is explicitly a tribe of mostly vapid himbos, then, you know, that makes for less good TV for the most part than these hot messes and freaks on the other tribes who are doing their best to make good TV. But also, I think, like, you look at the other two tribes on the season, you have Luzon, which is just an all-time banger of a tribe, and then the Brawn tribe, where you have Tony and Sarah, this iconic alliance throughout the arc of Survivor, and then also Wu, who has come back as a returning player since then. Even the other players there, like the sadly late Cliff Robinson, I think, is an interesting early character. Lindsay, while she's there before she quits, goes out with a bang. Mountie Fisher is a thing we didn't even get to in this episode, but I love that. That was fantastic.
As offensive as the sentiment may be, that is strong wordplay. I stand by the play on words, not the idea behind it, though.
Outstanding, yeah. And then Trish herself, of course, truly delightful as a Survivor character. So those two tribes, it would be hard for any tribe to really stand up to the two of those. I do wonder, though, if, let's say, you pad out Luzon with a few more people, if this is a 9-person, 10-person tribe, is it as easy for this combustible mix to really come together the way it did? You know, does it just end instead with someone getting picked off with a lot less fanfare and we don't get the truly iconic premiere that we had instead?
So I think there's definitely a lot of pros and cons to both sides of it. And you're totally right that if this is a tribe with more people on it, there's just no way for us to get that kind of Bluth family effect of, like, we can see how every single person is contributing to this kind of dysfunction, because there just wouldn't be enough airtime. And I also would say that just being in three tribes and having to take time over with the less interesting tribe or tribes out of sheer obligation for the most part is not going to be helpful in maximizing the entertainment value of the legitimately, like, dramatic and chaotic tribes. But I think still in theory, I would definitely stand behind being a staunch advocate for three tribes being a very good thing in Survivor, because I think when you consider just the worst seasons, a lot of them are situations where either one majority just kind of held it the entire time, or potentially even worse than that. And this is the real key to why I am such a big proponent of three tribe situations, is the swap in certain two tribe dynamics was so regularly a new dynamic where there was so much incentive for people to lose and just stick with the people they knew from their original tribe and pick off the people from the opposite side. And then when we get to the merge, now it's an even more exaggerated deficit than it already was. And that was as people kind of got to, like, the mid stages, based on what we know now of Survivor strategy, I think a super common thing. And it's because it made a lot of sense for people in the moment to go with that sort of plan, or at least the people they were casting felt like it made a lot of sense there. And that, I believe, is what we must avoid at all costs. Not at all costs, but if possible, that is what I think the Survivor producers should prioritize avoiding, is a post-swap and early merge dynamic that is just one big group sticking together.
I do wonder if, let's say you just didn't have a Beauty Tribe on the season, and instead you had, you know, two or three more people on the Beauty Tribe, or on the Brawn Tribe, sorry, two or three more people on the Brains Tribe, and they were maybe not at the caliber of the rest of the cast, because that is a tall order, but even just an approximation, they're able to hang in there. I think you still get an all-time great season, but maybe with even more ability to focus on some of those pivotal characters and relationships within those tribes. But again, I don't know if that comes at the cost of some of that early carnage.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as I said, there are so many pros and cons to each approach, and I honestly think Australian Survivor does a very good job. You know, they've had bigger tribes with three people that I thought was pretty interesting. And also the two mega tribes dynamic, where you start with, I think it was 24 people on two tribes of 12, where the idea of getting seven people coherently together for the length of the pre-merge that season, or that series, I guess, tends to have, is more or less off the table, especially with all the wild shit they're going to throw their way pretty much constantly, at least based on the current state of affairs down there. I think that could be a potentially really interesting dynamic as well. I don't see American Survivor casting that many people on any season because they don't need to fill 27 2-hour-long episodes or whatever. But I would be fascinated just to see modern American players in that kind of pre-merge dynamic where there are just so many people running around the camp and the end of the game is so far off in the distance. I think that could be something really interesting to see play out, even if we never will.
Yeah, so by my count, we are close to maybe even over 90 minutes in. Time is all blurring together at this point, and we've only got through one of these two tribal councils here. So we will be back very soon to break down the second part of this premiere, which in some ways, somehow, is even better than the first. And yeah, this David Samson boot, it's a fairly unceremonious first boot. We kind of have to shuffle through it to set up everything that comes later. He gets even less, you know, attention and spotlight than a first boot normally would. But this is still a perfect way to set the stage for everything that's going to come in the next hour of TV, which this premiere really just never takes its foot off the gas pedal even for a second. It's just great from pillar to post.
Yes, I don't remember how the episodes are ultimately going to be numbered or whatever, but this is definitely best consumed, and I think most often consumed by people in one sitting, these first two tribal councils. Yes, we did run quite long here today, so we're going to wrap up this part, but we will be back very soon and I do mean very soon in this case, hopefully going to be recording the next part of this tomorrow, so that hopefully won't take too long to get up as well. And whenever episode 3 or potentially episode 2, depending on whatever one Bryce gets voted out, whenever that episode is up on the patron feed, I will then release on the main feed these first two parts combined. So if you are hearing this there, continue with us the rest of the season over at patreon.com/DomandColin, and you will be swiftly transitioned shortly into the second part of this. And episode 3, as mentioned, up already by the time you're hearing this over at patreon.com/DomandColin. But for the actual patrons who are hearing this in real time, we're going to be wrapping up here. But again, back very, very soon, for sure, for real this time, with episode 2. Or 1 part 2. Not entirely clear, sorry.
Yeah, either way, had a ton of fun rewatching this premiere and coming in here to talk about it. Even more fired up now to get into that second part. So hopefully that will be with you very soon. Maybe even for some of you by the time you're done listening to this part. So immediate turnaround time on that. And yeah, I am really looking forward to revisiting this season. It's been for a season that I'm going to be talking about, I imagine, in very high regard as we keep on doing this. It's been surprisingly long since I just took the time to rewatch it. I'm surprised that in quarantine, I just didn't find an afternoon or two to bang that out, because it really is still one of my favorite seasons of TV, and not just reality TV, just of TV of all time. So a great way to spend an afternoon. And I'm surprised we didn't get to this at the beginning here. Maybe a good note to end on. I know this is one of the go-to seasons people bring up if someone asks, I'm trying to get friend, partner, whatever, into Survivor. What season should I start them with? This season is at the top of most people's list, and I think it's for good reason. And I think those reasons are very apparent, even on a rewatch, and I'm excited to kind of learn that and prove that once again to myself as we continue rewatching this.
Everyone who has asked me that question in the last several years has been started with Kageyan. I definitely...
Yeah, the only downside to that, I think, is you set the bar so high that then when they inevitably get into some of the kind of middling seasons, then their expectations are kind of warped at that point. But maybe that's fine. Maybe it's best to not bury the lead, to shove the lead in their faces and hope that they like what they see.
Right. I think it works to the genius's benefit that season one, episode one has such an incredible twist at the end, whereas Black Mirror comes to mind as a show that easily could, I mean, more easily than any show fucking ever could have put any other episode as part one and convinced a lot more people to stay with it. So I definitely think the Kageyan premiere, while obviously acknowledging that it is way, way above average for Survivor episode quality, I think setting the bar high has been, at least in my experience, an effective technique in getting people to actually stick with the franchise. But yes, Dom, let us wrap this part up now. We will be back one final time very, very soon for part two. Until then, thank you guys, of course, for continuing to support the show. We will be back very soon talking to you once again. So take care, everybody. Alright, welcome back, everybody. Here we are yet again in the Kageyan Zone. And Dom, I actually now realize, I realized it when I was editing the episode we recorded yesterday. I introduced that one as, here we are for the first time in the Kageyan Zone, when in reality it's more like, here we are for the 20th time in the Kageyan Zone.
You're forgiven. It's been a good while at this point.
Yeah. Well, it has only been about 24 real-time hours since we recorded part one, and I at least am very excited to be back in here recording part two. Still unclear if this is episode two, and you tell me where you are on this issue, Dom, because I may have landed in an unconventional spot here. For whatever reason, in my mind, I've always thought of the 2 hours together as the premiere, and that is episode one. But I've also thought forever that the episode where Bryce gets voted out is episode three. So what episode number do you think we are on right now? Is this 1A? Is this 2? What's going on here?
That is also what I thought on both of those counts. So I cannot be of any help to you here. And I have spent many years at this point not caring one bit about that distinction. And I plan to be stubborn and stick with my ways.
Stick with not having an invested, like, you're very strongly uninvested in this topic, which seems like almost an investment of its own.
I openly and brazenly uninvested. I don't care, Colin. You wouldn't believe how much I don't care about the topic, clearly.
I have landed on what we talked about last time is episode one, part one. In my mind, I have decided this is episode one, part two, and then next week is still episode three. So there just is no episode two on this season, as far as I am concerned. But Dom, a lot to be getting through here today as well. And I brought this up at the end of the last podcast, and setting aside the obvious semantics of which particular number you want to call this episode, I would say it is fair to expect people to watch them both back to back. Like, I feel bad that Hulu and other platforms have them split, because I really do think they play much better simultaneously, or not simultaneously, but consecutively.
I would agree. I think they are two parts of a whole. And if you did quit after the first half of this, you would have come away thinking, okay, that was a very solid premiere, but you wouldn't get the full majesty of this two-part extravaganza that we all experienced that first time in 2014.
Right. So let's get into it here, Dom. And this is, spoiler alert, going to be the week where we end up losing Garrett here. And I thought it was interesting and worth potentially diving into a comment that he makes at the beginning of this episode. Pretty big coincidence that they included this in the week where he gets voted out, almost like they're trying to set up a downfall of some sort. It's very, very impressive stuff there from the Survivor editors with these kind of Easter eggs, where Garrett's talking about how he wants to be on Survivor to outwit and outplay people, and I don't want to be here to survive in the wilderness, and these hide-and-go-seek type activities are not my area of expertise. Do you think that someone going out there thinking along similar lines is just actively wrong about what to be prepared for Survivor?
Well, we see Tony go on to make a Spy Shack and then go on to win 2 seasons of Survivor. So clearly hide and seek is a big element of successful Survivor gameplay. But yeah, not a great quote by Garrett, just firstly on the face of it. And then secondly, knowing that you are going to be on TV. And if you step a foot out of line, or God forbid, you get blindsided in this very news cycle, if you like, then that quote will be plastered across the screen, ready to set up your downfall. So really just a bad quote on all fronts. I don't think that the... Like, it's become commonplace to say that the survival aspect just means nothing in modern Survivor, and I think it doesn't in the sense that the show doesn't seem to care about it all that much, except when they're showing just some, like, bedraggled people on the verge of death, just as a hint that actually, yeah, the show is still tough, and you shouldn't just suspend your disbelief in that regard. But I think it does matter just in terms of preparedness and how ready you are to cope with the circumstances out there, because... You can be Garrett. You can put in more preparation time, just the raw hours involved, than anyone else has in the history of the show before, more than basically any permutation of people combined have in the past. And it's not going to matter if you get out there and you just start decomposing and you're falling apart mentally, which it seems like he really was. I don't know if, given his physique, like the food situation was taking its toll on him as well, would not be at all surprised about that. But you can prepare all you like under regular, normal circumstances. And even if you try to emulate the conditions of Survivor, it's always like when, you know, politicians do that thing where they go and live a week on the breadline or whatever, just to see how the other half lives.
Do they do that where you're from? Because that doesn't happen here.
They do it occasionally for TV under very contrived circumstances, or at least they used to back in the day, back when there was a market for that sort of thing. But it is always... not going to be fully authentic, because there is that knowledge in the back of their mind that I can always just break the fourth wall, break my fast if I want to, and go back to my regular life. And likewise, if you're training for Survivor, you can be you know, cutting carbs or going on some water fast in the comfort of your own home. That really does not compare to when you're having to do that. That's forced upon you on top of everything else you're trying to endure out there. So you really can't prepare for that aspect of things, no matter how much you prepare for everything else. And maybe that is what sunk Garrett, is that he went out there kind of very overconfident in just how ready he was to handle all of this. And then when it turned out to be just not remotely how he expected, he just, everything, at that point, the entire edifice just crumbled before him.
Yeah, I definitely think that sounds right. And I don't think Garrett was caught off guard by having to survive in the elements. I think he... was unsatisfied with the ratio of how much survivalism was actually involved versus how well the game was potentially going for him early on, and how just comfortable he felt at that tribe in the first place, just even coming off of a first vote that went well prior to seeing that play out. You know, he was immediately isolated. And one thing that I do believe is probably worth flagging up in advance, and I think it ties into a larger conversation about Survivor that I'm positive goes overlooked in so many cases historically, and we are absolutely guilty of this ourselves, but because this is going to be the last real opportunity that we're going to have to talk about Garrett on this season, I do want to
It's our show. We can talk about him whenever we like. But yeah, I see where you're coming from there.
I do want to flag up that Garrett is an all-time example in my mind, because I, too, am a professional poker player, although nothing at all close to Garrett. And that's kind of the point, which is, I think one of the things we as the Survivor fan community tend to not really think too much about is how people look on TV versus how they actually are in real life. And I will absolutely acknowledge that even like Garrett's pregame interviews were not necessarily him coming across super well, but this is just one specific case where I certainly don't know Garrett personally, but I do know a fair amount about Garrett, the poker player, and anyone, frankly, who is very familiar with poker knows Garrett too. And the reason for that is, at least in American poker, short of like the games in Bobby's room, he's not Isaac Haxton or whatever, but he's not far off. Like Garrett is one of the most known and most successful and most feared poker players in the entire country. Like when people go on these big live streamed games, like Live at the Bike or whatever, Garrett is the guy who is always there, always crushing everyone, and he is literally called like the end boss of live poker in America, more or less. And that does not come through, I would say, on Survivor, and I am absolutely certain, Dom, that if I did not know of Garrett outside of Survivor, I would be thinking exactly the same thing about him that everyone else seems to, and I am horrified to think about all of the people that also probably fall under this umbrella that have been on Survivor before, and I just feel like Garrett is a good place to flag this up, just because I do understand this so deeply from personal experience.
Yeah, Ronnie Bada comes to mind.
100%. Yeah, I mean, I almost brought this up. Sorry to immediately cut you off, Dom. But I almost brought up Ronnie when we were talking about the first boot and David Sampson being kind of a perfect fit for being in that mold. Someone who's out there trying really hard but not really having a ton of success at it. And I felt like Ronnie was also perfect in how he came across on the show in filling that kind of role, and I do generally agree that that is the best case scenario for the first boot. But like, I've met Ronnie. I play poker in Boston, and Ronnie's often home in Boston. I've randomly been at the table with Ronnie Barda before, and he is obscenely nice. He is nothing like he came across on Survivor, and is another perfect illustration, just a less prominent one, I think, in people's memories.
Yeah, well, let's get into the wider topic that this brings to mind then, because poker players have maybe one of the lowest success rates of any occupation on Survivor, and that includes the occupations which you might actively expect to have a bad success rate, which the opposite should be true of poker players, right? If you're able to kind of detach yourself and analyze the kind of game with that, you know, not letting emotions overwhelm you, and you're able to just kind of process all of that in the way that you need in theory to succeed at poker. That being said, there have been many, many successful poker players who have had rage issues, shall we say. You know, former associate of the podcast, Daniel Negreanu, might come to mind, or who, you know, like, part of the job of playing any game with variance for a living is understanding that the vast majority of people who do play it also lack an understanding of, you know, how to manage tilt, or just a basic understanding of variance, probability, the, you know, how luck operates in everyday life. And so it's not enough to say, well, you know, young Jimmy has learned to play cards, now he's up and ready to go out there and play Survivor. It's a lot more complicated than that. But why do you think it is? And we've had cause to revisit this topic so many times over the years that, forgive me if this sounds like a repetitive question that you've heard before, but why do you think it is that poker players just are so bad at Survivor, Colin, to put it bluntly?
So to go back to my last name drop, I, at one of the times where I was at the same table with Ronnie, asked him this exact question, which is kind of awkward to ask to a poker player who did poorly on Survivor to his face. But he gave the first and foremost correct answer as far as I'm concerned, and that will be the place I will begin as well, which is, number one, small sample size. And that, but that's kind of the point. Is,
well, no, I think at this point it is a large enough sample size to conclude so that there is something good.
This is the issue. That's just mathematically not true. That is quantifiably not the case. But I furthermore think
hold on. So is quantifiably not true that this is a large enough sample size, or that
however many poker players have been on Survivor, it is not 30, and that is the bare minimum for a sample size, as far as a mathematician would tell you.
I feel like there is enough to note the trend and ask questions about the trend. I don't think, you know, like, it is a very poker player answer to get out of that question by saying, oh, well, it's not a large enough sample size. If it was any other population of people, any other profession, I'm not sure what excuses they would be making for themselves instead, but that would not be one of them.
Okay, so this is an entirely unrelated sidebar, but one thing that I feel just goes without saying is that we still haven't even really seen we've seen plenty of seasons, and it's taken plenty of time, but we are nowhere near the point where we can say anything kind of like conclusively in more or less any respect about like trends on Survivor, along the lines of what type of person generally does better than what other types of people However, I will absolutely grant that, setting aside the issue of sample size, which I at least personally believe is absolutely in play, issue number two is they're not inclined to put random poker players on. There are certain characteristics that I think weight them more heavily towards potentially at least poker players who will do less well than other more than the average professional poker player might do. But I think the real answer, Dom, and the answer you are not necessarily looking for here, but the idea behind why this may be a trend, and I don't even necessarily disagree that this over a much larger sample size would continue to be a trend. I do think this is an issue for poker players on Survivor, and I honestly think this is something I deal with all the time in my own real life, which is the reason you get to be a professional poker player is because you think about variants and situations like this that you were facing on Survivor so much differently than is naturally like intuitive to the average human. Like the reason that this can become people's full-time jobs is because so much of what goes into playing good poker is so counterintuitive and makes people kind of uncomfortable, and you literally like rewire your brain. And I'm positive there are people out there hearing this right now that that know exactly what I'm talking about, where I honestly think, and this is probably not as big of go ahead.
What you're saying is, if you want to play professional poker, you need to get on the good stuff. You know, you really need to, you know, seek that out and let yourself transcend to another plane of understanding.
Well, so I think truly that there are just so many spots in higher level poker that would make people very uncomfortable. And one of the best things that poker players have going for them is they never have to convince anyone else to do what they think is the right thing to do. Like, they get to unilaterally decide everything for themselves, and that translates to a lot of success in many cases and a very happy and independent life. But that is not necessarily good preparation for Survivor, and I think that is potentially the big combination of factors coming together here against Garrett and against many of the other poker players we've seen put out there, which is, number one, just kind of thinking about games so much differently and thinking in terms of, okay, well, if they're prioritizing maximizing their own profit, then they'll want to do this. And also, you know, combining that with never having to convince anyone else of anything, basically ever, to continue being happy in life.
I do want to push back on the sample size thing one last time.
Okay.
Because when we come in here regularly and say things only like semi-jokingly, like, why are cops so good at Survivor? Why are gay people so good at Survivor? Why are Mormons so good at Survivor? You know, why are gay Mormons just absolutely broken at Survivor? I think it's reasonable to ask, why is it another group that we have as many, if not more, instances of at this point? Why are they so bad at Survivor? I think that does cut both ways.
I don't disagree that in general, I believe this is a trend that would be consistent if we had a larger sample size. The same way I believe that being a cop is extraordinarily good preparation for going out and playing any game that involves this much lying on your feet and observation, lying quickly, you know what I'm saying, and observational skills and all the things Tony has laid out for us already. I definitely do agree that if we were to reach a meaningful sample size, both of those trends probably would still be quite consistent. I just don't believe we are there yet in either of those cases from a purely mathematical perspective.
Given that so many of the Survivor winners have now started playing poker either as a serious hobby or just like as a profession, you know, full time, you've got Boston Rob, Tyson. I know Kim likes to dabble now and then.
I don't think she likes to. I think she felt forced to and then immediately regretted it on season 40.
Well, sure, but like half of the people who have ever played Big Brother Canada, it seems, are now professional poker players. Like, maybe we can now retcon this so that, you know, we take ownership of all the ones who did well on their seasons and we just kind of ignore the ones who didn't do well on their seasons. So, yeah, clearly, you know, the example of Boss and Rob and Tyson and Jeremy shows that just playing poker makes you an elite god when it comes to a Survivor. But more on that story as it develops, I suppose. Let's listen to what Garrett actually says when he's explaining his predicament here. Because as with most Garrett confessionals, it really is quite fun to listen to.
But I'm not having fun playing Survivor. This isn't fun for me right now, I have to be honest. Manual labor isn't fun. Starving isn't fun. Like, it's not like a cool adventure for me.
Did you remember it's all about oxygen? So when you build it, make sure we get the airflow
separated a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When I'm playing poker, I'm sitting in a comfortable chair. Chicken and vegetables are like being brought to me right at the table. I want to play Survivor like to outwit and outplay people. Like, I don't want to play Survivor to survive in the wilderness.
So my question for you is, when you yourself are in the midst of a successful session, you've just deprived some ornery Boston racist of his retirement money, you're lounging back in your chair, you're resting on your laurels, you snap your fingers, you beckon the waitress over. What is your go-to order when you're looking to chow down?
So I bring my own food to poker, and I am kind of grossed out by eating at the table without utensils. I go and take a break and eat in my car with a fork and so forth. But I will say this.
I'm just imagining you, like, retiring to your car, just like, hunched over your fries or whatever, just like listening to music to pump yourself up, just pumping your fist, like just really celebrating with yourself.
I promise it is far sadder and less exciting than that. It is we don't need to get into the specifics of my personal cooking and audio preferences, but I would say that the food at poker generally does look pretty good if you're in some environment other than constantly passing chips back and forth with other people who haven't washed their hands, especially now in the year 2020.
I was going to say, it may just be an academic question at this point in history, but if someone is rediscovering this several years down the line, that may be how long this takes at this point, then maybe that's going to be a question that makes sense again. But what I love about Garrett and what I think makes his downfall so enjoyable to watch is that you would think for someone who has his profile, like he's this like incredibly mathematically minded poker player or whatever, we have seen instances of that archetype on the show who are just dull as dishwater to watch. You know, they maybe cannot contain their wolfiness, and that's interesting in and of itself. Just like everybody is sketched out by them, and so it's almost the talk about them becomes more interesting than they themselves are. But Garrett just has this weirdly jarring aspect to him where he's so expressive, and he's so, like, even when he's complaining, it doesn't sound like, oh, he's just moping around or whatever. It feels like he's really putting his heart and soul into complaining, you know? Like, he's a very fun character, if nothing else.
I think Garrett, and sorry for the people who did not watch this movie or listen to this podcast, or even those who did, who do not remember it, because we did this pretty randomly a long time ago, but Garrett is, as far as I have ever been able to tell, squarely in that Barkley Marathons, Brett Mounie kind of territory. Mm. And we've talked about, I feel like Sophie Clark has been someone who kind of has come up along these lines as well, of what is appealing to Garrett is doing things that other people just can't do. And I think when you just look at him, that is pretty clear as well. And I could see that playing a role in Garrett's kind of demeanor with the cameras, is almost being kind of in disbelief at how ridiculous his situation has become this quickly.
And especially with the tribe that he is on, right? Like, if he was on a normal Survivor tribe and things were going somewhat badly for him, then okay, you put your neck to the grindstone, you try and rally back. When it's just complete utter chaos and none of it makes any sense whatsoever, then for someone who is used to making everything make sense, and it's a hard pill to swallow for sure. And I guess that this is the whole conceit behind the white collar versus blue collar versus no collar idea as well, is that you take these people who have basically succeeded at everything that they've tried in life, and now put them into a situation where there is more democratic control, if you like, where they can't just force everything to go their own way and see if they're able to actually handle that.
Right. I totally agree, and I do think that another potential element, and sorry for spending so long on this, but in poker, when other people mess up, that's very good for you, and they can't just, like, refuse to acknowledge it. They have to pay you. If they make a bad call, you get paid. Whereas on Survivor, if enough people just don't agree that they're making a mistake, you're just kind of screwed.
Well, sure.
Yeah. So, again, I understand how this is probably coming across to a lot of people, and I do not intend for this to just be the Garrett Adelstein defense hour here, but he had, just because of how regularly I have seen Garrett after Survivor, not in person again, but just crushing every live poker table that is put in front of him, I do feel compelled to say, not just about Garrett, but about, I am sure, so many other people, and I wish I had even a list of conceivable names here that I could pull as examples, but there is absolutely no doubt in my mind, and this is a situation, Dom, where sample size is absolutely meaningful, just the sheer number of contestants that have played on Survivor and been early boots. There is literally no question at all that many, many, many of them are extremely talented, smart, capable, successful people in real life. And furthermore, and we do flag this end of it up more often, and maybe that is a reflection of our priorities kind of being backwards, but there is absolutely no question in my mind that double digits, dozens and dozens of people who were pre-merge boots that ended up looking terrible on Survivor under different circumstances could have been regarded as some of the greatest players of all time. And I am not at all saying that Garrett is necessarily one such person there, but those people absolutely exist in both of those capacities. And I think that is totally lost on a lot of Survivor fans.
Are you saying that Garrett could have been, like, maybe just a little bit?
All right, we're moving on, at least for the moment here, Dom. There are other people.
I won't know on Garrett that it would not surprise me at all if, having spent literally thousands of hours preparing for Survivor, after his boot, he never watched another episode again. Like, I think that outcome is fully in play.
I would definitely doubt that he never watched the show again, but I would be also very surprised if he was a regular watcher of the show again.
Yeah, he's someone who does have enough other good stuff going on for him that it's not like, I'm sure he was crushed in the moment by the way he went out, but like he's able to rebound. Like, this is not going to be preoccupying him after all this time.
Yeah, we'll hold off on some other hot Garrett takes for later on in the show. I still got a couple in the chamber as things pertain to the buddy system of it all and so forth. But Dom, let's get to a couple of the other developments here from episode 1B or whatever my brain has weirdly decided to call it. We flagged up briefly last time the bond forming between Bryce and Morgan over on the beauty team. And we see now in this second half of the premiere that I'm still uncertain what to refer to as, that they are now trying to bring in Jeremiah. The country folk need to stick together. We also talked a bit last time about just the impact of being on six person tribes in general. And I think this is kind of a byproduct of that is, you know, these two immediately feel nervous. And when it's only six people, they are probably more motivated than they otherwise would be to really put the pedal to the floor before they're almost just out by default if the other four end up coming together here. But I wanted to get just your thoughts this episode, if any, on the beauty tribe and how things are playing out there.
I don't really have any at this point. And I think the beauty tribe suffers not only from being the least, not the least telegenic, because the whole point is they are the most telegenic tribe that we have on the season, but I think they are the least engaging from a personality standpoint, But also, the fact that they just don't really lose all that much, right? Where with the Brains, I think we'd be watching as much of them as we possibly could, regardless, even if they were winning every single challenge. But then also the fact that they lose three of those first four challenges really does play a lot into that distribution of screen time. And then for the Brawn team, yes, we don't see them go to tribal council early, but often those tribes that don't get a chance to release that pressure through voting someone out are the ones that are the most combustible. So you think about Tandang being the famous example, where tremendously successful tribe by some metrics, like just never losing a challenge, but then also that means that you have these tensions bubbling beneath the surface, and usually as they reach the surface, they will get defused because one of the people involved will get voted out. They don't get a chance to do that. So instead, those tensions just spill over and explode, and that makes for great TV. And so that's kind of what you get on the Brawn tribe as well. And then the Beauty tribe is in this like weird in-between spot where it feels very much like a regular survivor journey for a tribe pre-swap, where you lose one challenge, you vote out the guy who was always slated to be the first boot, and then you just kind of move on with your lives. And there's no real like deeper conflict to speak of there.
Yeah, I feel like the Beauty tribe is often what we find both or all three of the tribes looking like on some of the worst seasons of Survivor. But when it is kind of balanced against all of the absolute madness and carnage going on with the Brains tribe on top of the wild characters we're getting with the Brawn tribe, I think the Beauty tribe on this season is one of the best illustrations of something I don't know if I've always even necessarily subscribed to the extent that a lot of others probably have, but I do think they serve as a good example of how valuable having some kind of balance with the cast is versus a full-blown 18-person, everyone's all over the place playing Knives Out Survivor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I don't want it to come across like I don't value what the Beauties are bringing to the table here, even if it is, as far as I'm concerned, like what they're bringing to the table is kind of letting the table relax for a minute. I feel like it is a welcome addition on a season, if for no other reason than it makes everything else kind of stand out so much more and come across, at least for my money, as a lot more organic than if they're constantly trying to force that kind of dynamic with whoever they end up putting on the show. I'm looking through my notes here. I don't know that the Beauties have too much else going on here in this episode, and it feels weird to spend the first 20 minutes talking about one guy and then skip over an entire tribe here, Dom. But I guess actually, one thing that I kind of regretted not talking a little more about in our first part, and maybe this is a good time to run the clock out a little bit here with some of the people on the Beauty tribe to just kind of get our general early game takes, is the fallout we saw with Morgan and her idol clue that she didn't end up able to come away. She was not able to get the idol right away and will not be able to come up with it later on either. But when she is by herself at the camp off looking for it, her whole team rolls up on her and she hits them with the lie that her decision was to take camp supplies and shelter stuff, I think, is the way that she, or rice and shelter, whatever it was, and shelter stuff. It really stood out to me as kind of funny because they all knew Jeff had set up for everyone that whoever gets singled out is going to have some sort of decision to make. What did you think about that by Morgan? It's certainly something we've seen from other people as well, where they take the clue for themselves and then lie and say that they got the neutral box, for instance.
I think there are two things that diffuse the impact of that a bit here. And so the first is that just bias, where Morgan just does not seem like the type who you need to be scared of running around looking for idols, finding idols, and really scheming on what to do with them. Whereas if it's, you know, the Garrett type or the David Sampson type, like skulking around in the woods, if you catch them, you're going to be suspicious about what they're doing. You know they are on maneuvers to try and find an idol and get something together. And then the other thing which doesn't work so well for her is just the fact that she is already not taken very seriously by the other people there, and she's already rubbing people the wrong way just with her personality. That serves as a distraction from the fact that you should be talking about Morgan anyway, because she probably has a clue of some kind, or she was given some choice or some task or something. Instead, it's we kind of take it for granted that we want to vote Morgan out because we already don't like her, so that kind of overpowers everything else.
Interestingly, sorry to compulsively say this 10 times per episode, but I feel this is a situation worth readily acknowledging. Obviously, the TV edit is going to play a huge role here, and I'm sure conversations were had on both of these beaches with varying degrees of skepticism for both Garrett and Morgan, but at least the way it's presented on TV, it did seem funny to me, and potentially interesting that LJ, at least in particular, is skeptical of Morgan and what she was doing over on the rocks, and maybe she has a clue, and she's hot and not cute, and you can't trust the hot ones, or vice versa, whatever it was, that LJ was saying. It did seem like there was some kind of scrutiny on Morgan, whereas as things pertain to Garrett and what he was up to, Spencer tried to open the door and begin a conversation about what may have gone on when Garrett was by himself by just saying, you know, isn't it kind of weird that we haven't really heard anything about the idol yet? And Garrett's like, yeah, I haven't heard anything either. And that's really the end of that. Now, again, I'm sure many other people were wondering about the idol on the Brains camp as well, but it is, at least on the TV episodes, as far as I could tell, kind of funny that the Beauty Tribe seemed far more nervous about Morgan having an idol than the Brains did about Garrett, who actually had an idol and kind of fits that demographic right. They probably would have been looking for a lot more to a T.
Yeah, I think that's the opposite thing in play with Garrett, where you assume everybody on the Brains Tribe, whenever they have a spare moment, is going to be like sticking their hand in a tree or just looking into a crevice somewhere, just in case, you know, just on the off chance.
Yeah. We don't really see a ton of idol scrambling from the non-Garrett Brains. I guess, you know, from a TV perspective, the idol's already been found. The audience knows they're not going to see anything when others are hunting for the idols themselves. And I'm sure that plenty of that was going on. But Dom, over at the Braun Tribe, where people know Trish turned down some sort of clue for herself to get extra rice for the team, we have Tony Vlachos right away in retrospect, the most obvious scene of this entire first couple of hours, probably. But knowing what we knew about Tony in the moment, which was virtually nothing, it was pretty incredible to watch this guy take such initiative early on here, and he is not only going to go out and find the idol for himself, this is huge, he needed this, and so on. We also, Dom, get our first glimpse of the lengths to which Tony will go to gain intel here in the form of the original Survivor Spy Shack, which has obviously now taken on a whole life of its own here, but hilarious, honestly, to watch this scene back all these years later as Tony has to like set up for the audience the entire idea behind the Spy Shack. And isn't, you know, we're all sitting here thinking this is crazy, this is never gonna get him anywhere, who's not gonna notice a random dude hiding in a bush behind them. It is wild to watch the early days of all of Tony's shenanigans, knowing the extent to which they are going to aid him along the way for three seasons and two victories.
It's great, too, for Tony that he almost gets a free run of looking for the idol on the Braun Tribe, where of the three people who were nominated as the weakest and then given that choice of do you help the tribe or do you help yourself, Trish decided to help the tribe. She doesn't have any interest in being selfish and looking for that idol, at least in the short term. And then thinking about the other people on the tribe, maybe Sarah is the one actually most likely to be with Tony or competing against Tony looking for that idol. But for everyone else, I don't think Wu is going to be too active in looking for it. I don't think Cliff really is maybe familiar with the concept of idols or Survivor. I think he's just kind of out there doing his thing and people are really warming to him and like his social game seems really on point. But I don't think he's like hustling in the sense of I need to find an idol as well to cement my position. And then Lindsay is just listening to Cliff arguing with Trish. She's got a lot on her plate, Colin. She doesn't have time to be out there looking for trinkets. So Tony is the only one really thinking about the idols in the first place. And so even if it was just someone without his prodigious idol-finding talent, they might be more likely to find it anyway. And because it's Tony, it's like, well, just give it to him already. Don't even make him look. Why bother?
Yeah, I was wondering to myself as I was watching this back, just like seeing all over again the mode that Tony is just immediately in and will stay in for his 80-whatever days that he will eventually play on Survivor of just pedal to the metal 24/7. I mean, he legit talks about not sleeping or barely sleeping because he just stays up all night thinking about the game. And I genuinely do wonder, as someone who is honestly kind of uncomfortable describing anyone as the greatest Survivor player of all time, or, I've certainly done my share of rankings and so forth, but would never allege that like someone is just conclusively the greatest. I do wonder, though, what it would take for someone in the future to even have any branch of the Survivor community arguing that they're like undeniably a better player than Tony, just given how much obvious effort is going into like every single round that this guy plays and how little time he takes off. It's like it would take someone winning like 10 Super Bowls to be conclusively ahead of like Tom Brady in a lot of people's minds. Not my mind. Tom Brady is a system quarterback, but in a lot of people's minds, and I think defensibly so, it is very hard to wrap their head around the idea of what could even be done to overtake that. And I think with Tony, that element kind of is in play, just given how hard he is going around the clock. It is unthinkable to me to think about like what any future player would have to do to overtake that kind of status.
Well, I think first of all, you don't get points for effort. The fact that Tony is out there working harder than anyone, I don't know if that's true, first of all, but if it is, that doesn't really tell you anything about how good a Survivor player Tony is. Like,
I'm talking effort plus results, to be clear. I mean, to have it work out twice. What I'm getting at is, it seems like it almost requires someone playing an even crazier style, if that's even possible, than Tony to overtake that.
Yeah, I think there may be a kind of double standard at work here, though, where if someone does it so well that they make it look too easy, then we give them less credit because, they must have been playing against idiots or whatever. Like, I don't know how much stress Kim Spradlin was ever really under on her season, but that gets used to detract from the fact that, she played this incredibly dominant game and no one could ever really hold a candle to her. And so you almost have to be on the other extreme where Tony is, or you have to be in the middle, whereas, I don't know exactly where that threshold is meant to be, is what I'm saying. Where, like, maybe the actual best player of Survivor, if you were able to somehow divine who that is going to be someone who honestly does not have to put that much effort in. And in theory, it's more likely to be someone like that than someone who has to be grinding it out 24/7 just to stay afloat.
So I totally agree with that. I don't even mean equity-wise. I don't mean the most effective Survivor player. I mean perception-wise. It seems like Tony is essentially, and sorry to bring this back to poker, like the guy who is playing so unconventionally, but somehow making it work, and like a Tom Dwan type or like Phil Ivey, like back in the day, just doing things that no one else would ever even consider in tons of different spots. And like when that style does actually go as intended, there's virtually nothing anyone can do to be like more jaw-dropping, and the perception is more what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think would be interesting to see if anyone can even get in the conversation with Tony as things pertain to that kind of approach to the game there. But yeah, I also thought it was really interesting and kind of an element I had forgotten about, that so much of this, at least as it's presented again on TV, was inspired. I don't think there was much that could have kept Tony sitting down one way or the other, but at least as he's presenting it, he's so nervous about Cliff Robinson and the influence that he seems to be picking up right away with at least Wu and Lindsay and Trish. And it is nerves about Cliff potentially right away taking control of the majority of this tribe that is inspiring Tony to be spy shacking and looking for the idols and planting all these seeds and so forth. And I do, again, not expect that Tony under different circumstances would have had a noticeably altered approach here. But I do think this may be another area where we are seeing the effect of a tribe of six people really lighting a fire under people to a greater extent than necessarily would be the case if it was a bigger tribe.
Yeah, if it's a tribe of 10 and Cliff has his one or two disciples, well, that feels harmless in the short term. You can deal with that problem when you need to, and in the meantime, capitalize on Cliff's strength and challenges for whatever that's worth. But when it's a tribe of six and it is literally everyone other than you and Trish who you think is in a race to tunnel firmly up Cliff's backside, then it's so easy to feel boxed in and that you have to act now, if that's even possible, or else your game is over before it's even begun. And I wonder if, in a way, the fact that it seems so effortless and easy for Cliff makes him more threatening to Tony than if Cliff was hustling at a tiny fraction of the level that Tony seems to feel he needs to, because it's like Tony is out there, nose to the grindstone 24/7 doing his thing, and Cliff is just like sauntering up in his very kind of like laid back, chill way, and he has Wu falling over him. He has Lindsay saying to Sarah, "I'm in love with Cliff." Interestingly, Tony lumps in Sarah with the people who were at Cliff's knee, listening to his every word. Sarah,
well, to be fair, I mean, they're only like 5'8", and Cliff is 7 feet tall, so reaching up to his knee is kind of impressive.
Yeah, maybe the knee is too high, if anything. But eventually, Sarah is able to kind of pry away from that, and they're able to seize the majority. But it takes time, you know? And so for Tony, I wonder if and I can't remember actually what Tony himself said about this when we spoke to him, but had the Braun tribe gone to a tribal council before the swap, I don't know exactly what would have happened.
I am not entirely sure either. I will say I tried to listen to our season premiere podcast just to see what we were thinking at the time.
I
did not make it literally 3 seconds. I couldn't deal with the audio quality and my tone of voice, and all of it was just a disaster. I literally shut it off before I got through the introduction of me setting up who we were. But I would at least be open to... Sorry.
It would have been truly dreadful if you got to where I was talking with my audio quality and my tone of voice. You know, that would have been even worse. But
I am open to going back and listening to the Tony interview, though. I think that would be worthwhile.
Or we could just read the transcript of it. I spent a full week transcribing 4 hours of Tony, which is just as difficult as it sounds, people. So any kind of gratitude for that would be very much appreciated.
All right, so I don't know if I even explicitly asked this question, but I certainly was thinking it back when you did that. Why did you do that? Why did you feel compelled to sit and write down 4 hours of Tony?
I think it was because it was so long, and we were not well established at that point, and asking anyone to listen to basically a 4-hour-long podcast seemed like a tough sell. So I thought, if I can put it down in a more digestible form, that seems like a good idea. Of course, I had to do that because it was so long, which meant that the task in front of me seemed Olympian. And by the time I'd got, 20 minutes in, at that point, I was mostly just running on the sunk cost fallacy. It's like, well, I've started, so I may as well finish. And, after 3 or 4 days of that, I may as well finish part did not seem so obvious to me anymore, but I did it anyway. I stuck it out, and I won't say was handsomely rewarded for it, because I wasn't, but, you know, it's there if you want to read it, or if we want to read it.
Well, I'm handsomely rewarding you with my skepticism all these years later, so I hope that payoff was worthwhile there.
I'd hope for nothing else, honestly.
Yeah. But I did think that was kind of an interesting element. You know, we talked again last time about just the merits or lack thereof, or maybe the impact is a better way of describing it, of being in a tribe of six people versus a bigger tribe. And in a bigger tribe, as you said, Cliff getting a couple people as very obviously eager to kind of line up and go along with whatever he wants, in a bigger tribe, maybe one of the better things Tony can ask for. It's very easy to point that out to a bunch of people and say, hey, we may be nervous about this. Like, if you're not in with Cliff, it seems like that is a reason to be concerned, and maybe we should handle that before things go too much further. But on a tribe of six, if Cliff has a couple people immediately at his disposal, that could mean Tony just has zero room to play, and that's more or less what we're seeing over on the Beauty Tribe with Morgan and Bryce.
Yeah, I don't know if he would have seen, assuming Tony is the first target, which I don't know if he would be. Like, maybe it would be Trish, kind of on the same reasoning that led her to be the outcast initially. And if Lindsay is really strongly pushing for Trish to go to Cliff, then maybe Cliff just kind of goes along with that, because why not? But then you have the question of, does Tony try to use his idol to save Trish and, like, blindside Cliff in the process? Do they try to, like, flip Sarah over and break open a split vote, if that's what's happening? Like, a lot of interesting things could happen on that Brawn Tribe, but we kind of, that gets kicked into touch. We never actually get to see that.
Yeah, you know what? On second thought, this season is garbage. I feel totally robbed that we didn't get to see what Tony would do if he was under some actual heat on this season, Dom. No, I would guess that Lindsay would probably be one of the more likely people, but I certainly am not willing to say anything with certainty about pretty much any dynamic where Tony is involved, but particularly one where they have so little time to really know each other. I could see that being one of the likelier spots potentially for things to go not as planned for Tony.
One thing to flag up here is when Tony's explaining how Cliff already has this stranglehold over the tribe, he says he has Lindsay, he has Weasel Wu. And that term, Weasel Wu, that was a big talking point as Kagayan was airing, and we kind of had the inside scoop on that, which we couldn't really say publicly. And then when it eventually came out that the reason was, and there were a few different reasons being mooted, but as far as I can tell, the official reason is that Wu was, like, using production supplies and, like, poking around in the medical supply box that had everyone else's stuff, and just, like, a lot of random things that you wouldn't really attribute to someone like Wu with his personality, but it explains a lot, including why people seem to dislike him and distrust him so much for someone who seemed mostly likable and inoffensive. But it's interesting that that term had already been affixed to him within, you know, this is episode two, so it would have been the first 6 days. So I don't know if Wu really got off to a bad start with that one.
I may be making this up, but I think that Tony interview might include the fake reason that he was called Weasel Wu, like, before it came to light. But yeah, it does, as far as I know, stem from, you know, setting specifics aside, I think most people were quickly aware of Wu being more inclined than the average contestant to kind of not follow the spirit of the game as far as the survivalism element was concerned. And I do believe that that was one of the reasons people were more comfortable leaving Wu around in the end game, is understanding that a lot of people had that issue with him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
and actually, I think with that in mind, going into the finale, if you'd known just in what, you know, how low regard Wu was held by the rest of his classmates, and this being a contributing factor to that, when Wu takes Tony, and it seems like Wu has outs to win, knowing that Wu actually is drawing dead against Tony, and I think he still beats Cass, which
wrecks Cass. He wins unanimously against Cass.
Yeah, the fact that he would have 9-0'd Cass or whatever speaks to how disliked she was as well. But if you know that, then a lot of that suspense actually comes out of the finale, and you still have that that vote for Cass being turned over, deciding the entire game and saving Tony from certain or seemingly certain elimination. But it does change the whole dynamics around. So I actually kind of like that that wasn't known for sure as the season was going on.
Just thinking about the end game now, sorry if I mentioned this when I was rewatching the, I guess it would have been in the finale relatively recently, but I do want to double back to this because as far as I'm concerned, it is the final immunity challenge, of course, in Kageyan that may be, for my money, the all-time Survivor sliding doors moment, where if one tiny, tiny thing, like the butterfly effect, if one tiny thing goes slightly differently, the entire course of history is altered. And we will certainly talk more about this when we get there down the line, but that final immunity where Wu beats Cass by half a second and then votes Cass out instead of winning the game himself, which then opens the door for Tony to go on to become this all-time Survivor legend and two-time winner that never would have really happened. And I would imagine in the scenario where Tony finishes in third place, pretty much no one ever is talking about Tony in anything close to the terms that he has talked about today as one of the most successful and most talented players Survivor has ever seen. And it all comes down to that final immunity where if Wu is just slower, if he, it would benefit him to be behind Cass, if he just loses that challenge, she votes Tony out and loses to Wu, I would imagine, and all of Survivor history looks different. So it really is crazy how much is going on with Wu in particular near the end that I think no one ever really thinks about, but has an enormous impact on the rest of the franchise.
Yeah, and as we get down there, we will definitely dive into that in as much detail as we can, because that really is a pivotal moment in not just the season, but also the history of the show, I think. But let's move forward on the season here. Is there anything else that we want to talk about on the Braun Tribe while we're still there?
No, I don't have anything in particular other than I do think they did a really good job of setting Tony up in the early days here. It's a careful edit, and I think it plays really well, knowing how not only this season is going to play out, but much, much better even knowing what Tony is going to become within the entire scope of just Survivor as a show. The early days of Tony really do deliver even more so than I had necessarily remembered. But no, let's do get into kind of the main event here, Dom. The Brains team is going to lose yet another immunity challenge here when they get a reasonable enough lead during the physical part, and then Jatia is going to let them down on the puzzle, and right away they get back to camp, and she can feel the heat from people that they're upset with how all of that played out, and she hasn't necessarily been seeing eye to eye with everyone on the tribe, and right away it seems like things may not be looking too great for Jatia, and the votes may be tough to move when Garrett is proposing that, hey, we all kind of see the writing on the wall here. What's even the point of having side conversations? Let's just enjoy our day together, make sure no one does anything too sketchy, and if we all just don't leave each other's sight, we can all feel great going into tribal council tonight. And ironically, Dom, that approach may ultimately be the best thing Jatia could have asked for.
Yeah, and Garrett is oddly petulant about it, too. It's like, how dare you want to go and have conversations, right? It's like someone suggesting they break the fundamental rules of the game by just doing the standard thing. And Tasha, like, what makes this so great is at any point, this conversation could have de-escalated, right? If Garrett just doesn't insist on this weird buddy system shit for no good reason, then this whole thing would have been avoided. And then once he does, Tasha could have, like, gone along with it and not really drawn Garrett's eye. And I think Tasha was always going to be safe with the way this played out, where the fact that she was seen as aligned with Jatia almost help to keep her safe, because if you're going after someone from that duo, it's going to be Jatia. That was going to be the consensus boot regardless. And if you're trying to flip this around, it's going to involve Tatra somehow. So she's safe. She is bulletproof for this round at least. And so she kind of has the freedom to really strike back hard at Garrett, and understandably so. But she really lets him know, like, she lets him have it. She lets him know she is not happy about this. And that could be his opportunity to kind of retreat and lick his wounds and apologize and say, yeah, I'm sorry, I kind of got ahead of myself, don't know what came over me. But instead, he doubles down, and then she doubles down, and it just really spirals out of control. And that's even before all of the other crazy shit that starts happening. this is just the prelude somehow.
Yeah, I mean, it is a weird dynamic, because as far as, like, if they are being honest with themselves, or with each other, excuse me, and they really do all want to just get together and vote out Jatia that night, then it is kind of understandable that Garrett would say, well, hang on, why would you want to go have side conversations if we're all blatantly on the same page here? We have our alliance. We know what's going on. Side conversations can only get in the way of that. And then from Tasha's perspective, it's, why can't we go have side conversations if we all feel good about each other? It seems like a pretty straightforward kind of situation. And the number one way to make me uneasy is to insist that no one can go have side conversations. So it is it's not squarely a Nash equilibrium kind of thing. I don't think either of them is necessarily handling this in like a game theory optimal way, but it is a fascinating kind of tug of war there between, well, hey, if you have nothing to hide from me, then why aren't you okay with this? And it's, hey, if you trust me, then why aren't you okay with me going and doing this? It really is a fascinating kind of dynamic there. And then on top of that, we have Jatia feeling so much pressure and stress from being kind of the obvious target as far as at least many members of the tribe are concerned, when they have this big group meeting and say, all right, we're just going to vote Jatia out tonight, right? That as Tasha finally is able to pull Cass away for a minute to just talk, which I think is a pretty reasonable thing to want to do, Garrett doesn't feel great about that. He follows them down to the beach and says, I would just be more comfortable if we all stayed together. And Spencer is right behind him there. And Cass is actually the first one to flag up, where's Jatia? Are we necessarily making a good decision here, leaving Jatia by herself at camp? And we then smash cut to Jatia, who is saying, they really shouldn't have left me alone here at camp. And Dom, in truly one of the most shocking moments, and I know I'm a bit prone to hyperbole historically on these Survivor podcasts, but I really do think it's kind of been lost to time just what a big deal it was to watch this play out live, where someone actually executes on the full brand enhance here and just literally dumps out the entire bag of rice. And even setting aside the fact that this person is not going to be voted out at tribal council that night, it is jaw-dropping to me to even think about what that moment was like in 2014 or whatever. I think, you know, knowing it's coming and having other people freak out over the years has kind of diminished the effect on a rewatch here. But when this happened for the first time and Jatia dumped the rice out, my jaw was on the floor.
Yeah, it was truly one of those moments that makes you like sit up and take note. And it's hard to separate it from the fact that she survives, because usually this is, okay, well, she has been told officially that she's going home, and so this is her making a statement on her way out the door and really putting the exclamation point on her survivor journey. And now when she sticks around, it's like, okay, just kidding, sorry about that. I was like, well, it's so, I imagine the day after the night before is so awkward now, because it's like, well, okay, how do I reintegrate myself, if that's even possible, given that I somehow have a new lease of life that I wasn't expecting, when I have just done my best to burn every bridge possible. You know, I have Tasha here trying to stick up for me, and I'm making her job as hard as it could ever really be. And then it seemed like Cass was willing to flip this around, and then I did my best to alienate her, and then it turns out she does flip it around anyway, but she still is very publicly not happy about what I've done. And then Spencer is just like flabbergasted by the whole situation. And this is just one small part of that. So it's really hard for her to like work her way back in. Now she's just kind of like in suspended animation almost. Like she's still in the game of Survivor, but just like her card is marked. She's there for as long as other people want her to be there at this point.
I mean, I'm sure we could go back and check on this, but it wouldn't shock me if one of the timelines we thought in the moment that was quite conceivable was, well, now that she hasn't been voted out immediately, if she swaps well, I could see Jatia being like a major right. endgame player.
Yeah, I think I said at the time, this may have been one of my first like big contrarian takes. I think I said like, keeping Jatia really does make a lot of sense, right, for that, like, Tasha Cass access. And it's so easy to think, well, if Jatia doesn't seem to want to stay and she's accepted her fate, then we'll just, you know, we'll agree with her and we'll send her out the door. But that was their chance to really make a move and seize control, and they took it, and I actually would commend them for that.
So I'll ask you now, in the year 2020, do you think Cass made the right decision in flipping over and keeping Jatia?
I actually do, yeah.
I don't think that's crazy at all. I don't remember you in your early days as the Edge Lord of Extinction, before the Edge of Extinction existed, voicing that. But the story definitely checks out, and I actually think that is a potentially interesting idea there. That maybe the consideration of having to win a challenge, or at least very much wanting to win a challenge, would be a bigger factor for other people. But I'm first of all not surprised at all when Cass is the person in question that she landed on this decision. And I also I think there is a reasonable, at the very least, amount of strategic merit to the idea of Jatia being someone who would be good to keep around, especially because and these people, I would guess, are few and far between for a Cass type, much like you were saying about Tasha earlier. As long as Jatia is in the game and on the same tribe as Cass, Cass is probably safe for the next round.
Right. It's almost like she has made herself into the perfect shield, the perfect buffer for anyone who can afford to tolerate her for as long as it takes.
Yeah. Well, let's get a little further into the buddy system of it all. If you at least the buddy system, people were allowed to go off in pairs, not individually, but they were allowed to go off with people we knew they weren't necessarily going to get up to any kind of nefarious activity with. We have this approach from Garrett that at the time I believe was relatively new, although Dom, we now, with the benefit of many, many more seasons under our belt, have seen this implemented again, and it fascinates me. Although, again, I think this is a story that solidly checks out, that if anyone were to attempt this down the line, Boston Rob Mariano, I think, is one of the funnier and honestly more predictable people that we could see implementing this kind of strategy. The inventor of the original buddy system, obviously, and I did think it was so funny on season 40 to have Rob show up and try this kind of thing, that everybody was raking Garrett over the coals for in real time. How could anyone be this stupid to think that this sort of thing would be a good idea? And then 6 years later or whatever, we have the consensus greatest player of all time, everyone's hero, the face of the franchise, Boston Rob, with 4 seasons, 100+ days of experience under his belt, playing against a cast of all winners who have no reason, compared to any cast before them, to just try to make it through to the next round, coming in there and trying to implement this exact same strategy. I really tried to play it cool and take the high road during season 40, but truly, if you had asked me to script the most embarrassing way Boston Rob could go out of the game in season 40, it would have been more or less that. So I wanted to take this opportunity to just get my actual thoughts onto the record for the patrons. And now I'm realizing this part will also be released publicly. So spot kind of blown up here on myself, but too late now. I not only with Boston Rob, but with Sandra as well, really could have gone a lot harder with how embarrassing their exits were, I believe.
We really did not make as much of it as we should at the time. That it's so funny in retrospect that the two mentors, the two people held up as these icons, these authority figures in the grand scheme of Survivor, those are the two who suffered the most embarrassing exits out of all 20, I would argue, in Winners at War. And it's almost like, well, yeah, you could have had any of these 18 other people, or at this stage, basically a lot of non-winners as well, as better candidates for, you know, tutoring people how to, you know, tutoring these neophytes on how to play Survivor. And it's so great that it happened to the two of them, like, in tandem as well, because you have the people who have been Sandra fans for, you know, over a decade, like really diehard in her corner. And then you have a lot of the maybe more casual fans who just love all things Boston Rob. And I guess you have the, you know, the gap in between is filled with, I guess, the people like us. It's the engaged fans who don't buy into the Sandra hype. But for the most part, being a Rob fan or being a Sandra fan or both at once covers the vast majority of people who still follow Survivor at this point. So for both of them to get clowned so thoroughly and so humiliatingly in the scope of one season really was something to behold.
I mean, like I said, if you had asked me to script the endings to those, to their two games on Winners at War, I would not have been nearly as heavy-handed about the way that their exits went down as the actual timelines were. Like, I would have personally requested, like, okay, let's have Boston Rob go out in a way that demonstrates he clearly does not grasp that other people have their own priorities and are there to win themselves. And let's have Sandra go out in a way so as to demonstrate, I mean, she does not begin to think about the strategic nuances of Survivor in nearly the same terms that her results would probably indicate in the minds of most people. Not thinking too far beyond that, it is mind-boggling to me how well both of those things came in. And I will now that enough time has passed, fully deliver on the Colin Stone, everyone I'm guessing was expecting to show up in real time as we were covering that. But, like, truly, I don't think I ever was really upfront about this as we were covering it in the moment, but, like, after those two eliminations went the way they did, I genuinely felt like I do not care how the rest of this season goes. I feel so validated for the last decade of podcasting.
It strikes me that it would be very hard to come up with two more different people and Survivor players than Sandra and Garrett, right? And in the scope of watching Tony's first winning season and then Tony's second winning season, you see these two diametric opposites fail in about as bad a way as the two of them could fail. And, you know, we've seen Sandra succeed on her own terms twice in the best possible way, so she can always have that to hang her hat on. But if you're looking at how things can go so badly wrong, like, Sandra and Garrett offer two very different visions of that.
Oh, I agree with that for sure. And I don't want to spend too much time here in the weeds on Sandra and Boston Rob of it all, but I do think it is yet another illustration of just the effect that the TV edit will have on the way that you perceive people. Like, I would imagine people who weren't huge Survivor fans who just happened to watch season 40 would be coming away from that season thinking drastically less of Sandra and Boston Rob than they would have virtually anyone else on the show.
Yeah, if you just had not seen that seasons of Survivor before, you had someone watch Winners of War as their introduction to the show, they see Sandra, they see Rob, and they think, why the hell do these guys have two giant totems of their head still, like, mouldering away at the side of this island somewhere? Like, shouldn't it be basically anybody else? And they would have a point if that's all you were going on.
It'd be very funny for someone, and this person must exist, just law of large numbers would dictate, someone watched season 40 and then immediately went into season 39 and must have just been confused as hell.
Yeah, it's like, all right, I'll start by working backwards now that I've got hooked on the show. And it's like, wait, hold on a second. Like, make this make sense for me.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are ultimately going to see Dom this not go as planned for Garrett here. And this 2-2 split that it seemed like most people were aware of within the majority alliance of that first vote where they left Cass on the outs. Everyone seemed to kind of recognize, okay, it's pretty clearly Spencer plus Garrett on this side of the alliance and Tasha and Jatia on the other side of the alliance. And Cass now gets to swoop in as this swing vote. And we've talked about the decision that she made, and it does, I think, make, there are at least plenty of compelling arguments to go that route. But do we have other examples? And I'm sorry for putting you on the spot. I guess I'm mostly encouraging other people to tweet at me or comment on the Facebook group or whatever, with other examples of it actually going this way. Like, for instance, I would guess that if the Beauties had to go back to another tribal council, Morgan would not have been the swing vote there. But in six-person tribes, does this happen more often than I'm remembering, or is Cass perhaps a low-key genius for working her way into this spot?
I am really racking my brains now, because it did feel like this tribe immediately divided into these three different pairs, and once you have that dynamic in place, this swing vote set up when you're down to five is inescapable. It's just like mathematically guaranteed to happen, basically. So I'm sure there are examples. I'm like running through my mental Rolodex of six-person tribes, and it's taken me a while. You know, I feel the senility starting to creep in here. But if you, as I'm buying time for me, and also for you, if you would be kind enough to jump in with any thoughts of your own.
So I'm thinking in the six-person tribe, it seems like more often than perhaps not at this point, we're mostly seeing one of the three tribes go to like three of the four pre-swap tribal councils. And it's rare that more than one of the tribes at least goes to multiple pre-swap tribal councils. So the sample size may be a lot smaller than I was necessarily considering when asking that question in the first place. And by the way, if you're playing the sample size drinking game, you are tanked at this point.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Dom, I guess let's get into then just parting thoughts on Garrett. I know we've talked a lot about him to this point, but what are your, if any, additional thoughts as we wrap up here on Garrett?
I think Garrett, for what he meant to us in terms of, like, if he can talk the talk, or wait, as if he can walk the walk as well as he talks the talk, then the sky's the limit for this guy. But also, if this is all just bluster, then he is going to meet an untimely end very quickly. So having that kind of high variance character in the mix was, I think, is always really fun. And it's in a sense tragic that he went out the way he did, but it was also inevitable. And I don't know if it can be both of those things at the same time, really. Maybe it being inevitable makes it more tragic. Maybe the fact that you see this coming in a way that he absolutely didn't. And we shouldn't gloss over the fact, too, that he goes out with an idol in his pocket, which I guess we've become a little more desensitized to that over time. But for that to happen in the first episode is definitely something to write home about as well. So an amazing exit here by Garrett. Loved really everything about it. Like, not just the fact that it happened and that it happened the way it did, but the all of the character drama that leads up to it. Jatia somehow staying after the ultimate act of self-sabotage and destroying the tribe's food supply. Just everything about it. It was a fantastic episode, and if you watch it in isolation as episode two of the season, then that's great. And if this had been, you know, we have the David Samson boot as week one, and then we wait a week, and then what we get in week two is this clusterfuck, then I think the season still would have been very well received through this early stage, but in maybe a little bit of a different way. But as it is, the fact that we heard only just about started recovering from that first hour, and then we get body slammed by the second hour, it really created this incredible viewing experience.
I totally agree. I think you nailed it last time in talking about David Samson being a perfect kind of first boot candidate, and I feel like Garrett is almost that on crack. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if under different circumstances they would have just done a one-hour Cagayan premiere. But this Garrett Vodoff, especially, of course, on the heels of Jatia dumping all the rice out and then still getting to survive the vote, is an all-timer. And I do think a very, very compelling case can be made that Cagayan had, if not the number one, certainly one of the greatest premieres of all time, largely because of this Garrett elimination here. And for that, I am extremely grateful to Garrett for filling in this role, because I do think it hits a lot harder when it is the Garrett type getting their comeuppance in the eyes of a lot of people. And I furthermore do want to just kind of double back on just the premiere itself being so important in setting up a Survivor season. And while the rest of Cagayan is, of course, extremely, extremely good, essentially from pillar to post, I do think having this absolutely explosive and shocking premiere night is one of the most vital factors that goes into making this such a good season.
Yeah, I would co-sign all of that for sure.
All right. So, Dom, it sounds like you have some dishes to go help unload. Anything else you want to get to this week?
I'm good.
All right. Well, that is going to wrap it up for us here today and wrap it up for the unlocked portion on the main feed. If you want to continue with us here, episode 3 is, by the time if you're hearing this on the main feed, it's already up over on patreon.com/Dom and Colin. And if you're one of the patrons hearing this in real time, of course, thank you guys, as always, for continuing to support the show. And we will be back with I am firmly saying this is now episode 3 we are going into next week, even though this itself wasn't episode 2 somehow in my mind. But very much looking forward to that. And just more generally, Dom, to echo a sentiment that was expressed to us earlier today by great friend of the podcast, Austin Trupp, it feels so good to be back in a legit kind of season of positivity. I think Cagayan is exactly what we needed right now for a season to cover.
And I would say this is a hot take, but I know that you have already beaten the drum on this quite loudly. I think it's good as well that we're not getting season 41 right now. I think actually having a break and just letting ourselves digest season 40 and not immediately rushing into how do we try and top that and inevitably like trip over ourselves in the process for season 41, that might actually be a good thing. Just take some time to let it settle. And, you know, it's obviously not great that has been forced upon us. I don't think that was a choice they wanted to make by any means. But now that that is a situation, I think them having the kind of long winter to decide what direction the show needs to take now, no guarantee that's actually going to lead to any kind of structural improvement long term. But if anything could, maybe that's it. Maybe that's the chance to reevaluate and slow down and stop for a second that they really needed.
Yeah, I feel bad that we don't have any kind of regular content coming out on the main feed without Survivor being a part of the routine these days. But yeah, as far as I'm concerned, if the show had kept going at its current rate, it is impossible to ignore the stark downward trend that this was taking. And I think there's very, very little, sorry for doubling up on so many of these adjectives, I'm now realizing there was no doubt in my mind that being forced, I don't think it's a bad thing that it was forced upon them. I think it was a good thing that it was forced upon them, because it never would have happened otherwise. I think having a mandatory break where they have much more time than usual to think through some major structural changes that I think need to be implemented is frankly the only thing that could have saved Survivor from itself. But that's another time for another topic, I guess, Dom, for another time. Let's get out of here. One last thank you guys for continuing to support the show. Patreon.com/Dom and Colin if you want to stay with us going forward. And should be back relatively soon with episode 3. So until then, take care, everybody.